Good morning, everyone. We're going to officially begin today's meeting of the Labor, Workplace, and Regulated Industries Committee. And let me just lay out what the game plan is so people are aware how we're going to move forward today. We have a variety of testifiers, well over 20 that have signed up, and we want to make sure that our colleagues and fellow legislators at the table here can ask questions as they feel so moved. And what we're going to do, members, is take approximately three testifiers at a time, and then once those three testifiers have completed, we'll just take a little break for questions so that you can ask those testifiers at that time the questions that you might have for them. So that's kind of how we're going to move forward with questions. We do have a room reserved tonight, room 5, in this building that we will pick up this particular meeting at 6 p.m. tonight if need be, and it's probably likely that we will do so. And to that extent, if you cannot be here this evening, we want to make sure we get your testimony this morning. So you need to indicate that to Kelly, our page here. Maybe she can keep track of that a little bit. If you absolutely cannot be here this evening, let her know so we can get your testimony yet this morning, and the members can ask questions at that time. One of the things to keep in mind, if you're going to, as you testify, this is just a little procedural thing, to go through the chair, that is to say, if somebody asks you a question, acknowledge me, the chair, just say Mr. Chair or something like that. And the purpose of that is then I say your name, and for the tape purposes, as people listen to this later on, to go over the testimony, they'll know who's been speaking. So it's just a protocol thing. If you hear me acknowledge, just go through the chair, just acknowledge me so I can say your name, and we get recorded who you are. We're going to formally move the bill, which is to say we're going to formally hear the bill that Representative Winkler is carrying tomorrow morning. So that's the plan there, and we'll be, as a committee, taking questions and issues and so forth about the bill beginning tomorrow morning, and we'll be voting on that bill then by 9:40 in the morning. The path for the bill, as it moves forward, would be to Jobs and Economic Development, Finance and Policy, which is Tim Mahoney's, Representative Mahoney's committee. So that's kind of the pathway. But before we start, any questions from members about procedure? We're going to be it's fairly informal for a formal process, and if you do have any questions as we move along, feel free to ask. But the main thing is we want to make sure we get the information from both sides, and that our members here get an opportunity to ask questions in that regard. So with that, let's get started for this morning. I'm just going to go down the list that I have here. And again, if you can't be here in the morning, make sure you let Kelly, you want to raise your hand again so they see you. Let Kelly know so that you can make sure that you get heard this morning. Jennifer Schaubuck, you want to come on down and identify yourself for the record. Again, members, we'll take three testifiers, and we'll take a little break for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Good morning.
One last comment, I'm sorry. We're going to ask testifiers, just so you can, as you plan your testimony, to limit their testimony to 3 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, so that everyone has a chance to speak. So that's kind of the time frame we're looking at. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jennifer Schaubuck. I am the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliate unions representing more than 300,000 workers throughout the state. I'm here today to speak in support of increasing the minimum wage. Some may wonder why labor would testify in support of increasing the minimum wage, as most of our members make more than the minimum. We are active and retired members of public and private unions who care passionately about what working people deserve. Labor has been and continues to be one of the greatest forces standing up for justice for all who work and against those who curtail that justice. The last time the minimum wage was raised in Minnesota was 2005. While compensation for chief executives at American companies grew 15% in 2011 after a 28% rise in 2010, part of a larger trend that has seen CEO pay skyrocket over the last three decades. Workers, on the other hand, have been left behind. Since 1978, CEO pay at American firms has risen 725%. That's more than 127 times faster than worker pay over the same time period. Raising the minimum wage right now is more important than ever. Minimum wage increases stimulate the economy by increasing consumer spending without adding to state and federal budget deficits. Consumer spending drives 70% of the economy, and increasing demand is key for jump-starting production and rehiring. A raise in the minimum wage puts money into the pockets of low-income consumers who immediately spend it at local businesses. Economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago have found that every dollar increase in the minimum wage boosts consumer spending by a low-wage worker's household by $2,800 over the following year. Strengthening the minimum wage can help build a sustainable economic recovery without increasing costs for taxpayers. More families than ever are relying on low-wage and minimum wage jobs to make ends meet. This is because job losses during the Great Recession hit higher wage sectors like construction and manufacturing hard, while new jobs being created have disproportionately been low-wage jobs. For example, the top three occupations in industries experienced job growth in 2010 were retail salespersons, cashiers, and food prep workers, all occupations with medium wages below $10 per hour. This is not a short-term trend. Seven of the top 10 growth occupations projected in the U.S. by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for the next decade are low-wage jobs, including home health aides, customer service representatives, food prep and service workers, personal and home care aides, retail salespersons, and office clerks. Raising the minimum wage would be a much-needed boost in incomes for these types of jobs where millions of Americans spend their careers. I'm going to shorten my testimony a little bit for you.
That would be great.
Most minimum wage employers are service sector businesses that are tied to a state because that is where their customers are. Businesses like fast food, retail stores, and home health service, for example. Indeed, a New York Times profile of businesses on either side of Washington-Idaho border at a time when Washington's minimum wage was nearly $3 higher than Idaho's found that businesses in Washington were flourishing despite predictions that the higher minimum wage would send jobs and businesses fleeing across the state line. It's also important to remember that since the minimum wage has lost so much value over the last several decades, employers today are actually being allowed to pay less in real dollars than they were in the late 1960s. Raising wages reduces costly employee turnover and increases productivity. Research has documented how, especially in low-wage industries, raising wages reduces turnover because workers who are paid more stay with their current employer longer. A study of the effect of a wage increase for workers in the San Francisco airport found that annual turnover among security screeners plunged from 95% to 19% when their hourly wage rose from $6.45 to $10 per hour. This reduced labor market churn yields significantly for employers by reducing recruitment, retraining, and restaffing costs, which both studies and trade association analysis have found to be significant even in low-wage sectors. In closing, the fact that the minimum wage has fallen to 45th in the country is a sad state of affairs. Now is the time to further aid in our state's economic recovery, boost the spending power of thousands of Minnesota workers, and raise the minimum wage to at least $10.55 an hour and index it to inflation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, Jonathan Reiner and Ashley Steele, are they with Bernie? Is Jonathan Reiner and Ashley Steele here? There they are. Okay. Welcome to the committee. And if you just identify yourself for the record, and again, if keep our testimony to 2-3 minutes, that'd be fabulous.
Ashley,
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. My name is Ashley Steele, and I'm here to talk to you today about minimum wage in Minnesota. No one could have told me when I enrolled at St. Catherine University in 2006 that 3 years after graduation, I would still be working as a restaurant server, earning minimum wage plus tips. I would, like many college students, I believed my parents, counselors, and teachers when they told me that if I did what I loved, the money would come. So after exploring many education courses of study, I chose sociology and then minored in French and critical studies of race and ethnicity. I worked full-time to pay my way through college, and where some students could ask their parents for money when there was a gap in their financial aid and tuition that needed to be paid out of pocket, I had my credit card. Some semesters, I would attend the first and second sessions of my classes, not knowing if I would even be able to register for the semester. Looking back, it really is a miracle that I was able to finish. However, my education has locked me in a cycle of student loan and credit card debt that I worry I will never escape. I have staggered my bills so that I have each time in between each one to earn enough tips to pay on time. Sometimes I don't know until the due date that I will even be able to pay. It causes so much anxiety that I often lay awake at nights, worrying about my finances. Sadly, there are not many jobs out there for recent graduates. I see my former high school and college classmates getting married, buying homes, and starting families, and I wonder if I will ever be able to have children or own a home. Even with tips, I am lucky if I have an extra $100 after paying rent, student loan payments, credit card payments, my car payment, utilities, car insurance, gas, groceries, and miscellaneous household expenses. Let's not even talk about going to the doctor. However, I know that many other minimum wage earners are in even more dire financial straits than I am. Many of my coworkers throughout the years have worked as servers because their wages were being garnished due to student loan debts that had gone into default. They never earned paychecks, but their tips allowed them to remain independent. Minimum wage in Minnesota is not just an issue of money. It's the difference between repaid and defaulted loans, renting an apartment and homelessness, self-sufficiency and dependence on the system. It's about bringing Minnesotans' dreams closer to reality and not pushing them farther off in the distance. I want to make good on my debt and contribute to society. Eventually, I would like to own a home, get married, and start a family, just like many other Minnesotans my age. And I urge you to remember us when making your decision to support raising the minimum wage.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Stan?
Mr. Chair, esteemed members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Reiner. I grew up in Forest Lake, Minnesota, and I now live in Minneapolis, where I am a law student at the University of Minnesota. I grew up in Forest Lake knowing full well, having two parents that worked low-wage jobs, knowing full well that I would have to pay for college if I wanted to attend. I got into St. Thomas University in St. Paul. I had generous state and federal grants, and I had generous scholarships from that institution, but I still had a substantial debt burden that I had to take on while working minimum wage jobs all throughout college. I have to reiterate a lot of the stories that you just had disclosed. It's an unfortunate state of affairs that we have to take on so much debt to pursue a degree that is required for jobs in this state. And it's just an unfortunate state of affairs that has to occur. I wanted my brother to come testify today, but unfortunately he's working a minimum wage job right this minute to pay for his college education as well. So I just want the committee to consider, is this the type of Minnesota that we want, where students have to take on multiple minimum wage jobs to finance their education, and when they do enter the job market, whether there are sufficient jobs to match those needs. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. And members, we're just going to take a brief break for questions. If anybody has any questions for these two testifiers or Ms. Shabak, who testified a few minutes ago. Representative Sundin has a question for Ms. Shabak. Come on up for a second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shabak, you mentioned the disparity between the high-income earners and the low-income earners. Minnesota and the federal government, you know, provide a lot of assistance to low-income families. And some of those assistance programs are gauged on a sliding scale according to income. And the other testifier mentioned two parents that worked in low-wage jobs. If we were to elevate the minimum wage for, let's say, two parents, two income earners in a household, I'm thinking maybe by $6,000 or $7,000 a year over the course of this legislation, how would that reduce their people's dependence on government programs? Is there any analysis of that? And I don't know if you can answer that or not. That's kind of a loaded one, but could you dig up some numbers on how that would affect the programs that Minnesota and the federal government provide right now?
Absolutely.
Ms. Schaubach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, thank you for the question. I think it would stand to be almost logical that folks would not be reliant on those kind of programs, you know, housing assistance, food stamps, those kind of things, if their wage was a livable wage and they could support their family on that. But we'll get you some numbers on that for sure.
Very good.
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shaba, you said that, first of all, you compared Washington, D.C. wages to Idaho, and I would, Washington, or I don't know. Anyway, you said one increased pay and one didn't. I just wondered if that was more of a supply and demand issue. I know that in the 80s, McDonald's was paying $10 an hour because they needed people to come in and work. So it's kind of a supply and demand issue. And then the second part was that you said the reason to increase minimum wage is to reduce turnover. I would consider that more of a private business decision and not really the purview of the state to decide if they have a turnover problem or not. If a company has a turnover problem, they are going to pay more money, and they're going to find their good employees, and they're going to pay them more, and that's what keeps them there. And I hear this at every level. And, you know, right here in Minnesota, we're having a hard time attracting higher-paid people because they're looking at the cost to them, and they're going, oh, you know, this isn't, so they have to pay them more. So I'm hoping that you kind of see this from my perspective and maybe could address that. Is it really the state's role to decide a business's turnover problem? Thank you.
Ms. Schaubach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, I don't think that's exactly how it may have come across. I think it's in a restaurant. I worked as a server and a bartender for 12 years, and the amount of turnover in a restaurant is, in a service industry, is there's a lot of it. I don't think the state is kind of dictating how, you know, an employer controls their turnover. But it has been shown in studies that turnover lessens when people get paid a decent wage to stay at their job. I know that when and it was Washington State, Representative Kiefer, not Washington, D.C. So it was a border state study that was done specifically for that reason, because we do hear a lot from the service, the hospitality industry, that, you know, businesses are going to close. And, personally, I think, as a server back in 1995, I lived in Washington State, and I made $7.25 an hour minimum wage, and was able to, on my husband at the time, his E-1 Navy salary, support our family between the two of us. Now we could not do that. The buying power of that minimum wage is nowhere near what it should be today. And their minimum wage now is $9.15 or $9.19 an hour. So
very good. And Representative Rademacher, you want to? Do you have a question?
Rudinovich, Mr. Chair.
I'm
thank
sorry.
You. It's all right. It's not the first time. Not the first time. Along the Mr. Chair, thank you, and to the testifier. Along the lines of Representative Sundin's question, I think his was, you know, if you were to raise the minimum wage, do you feel there's an effect where we would have less people relying on programs? I guess my question is, do you know of or do you believe that our state support programs subsidize low wages?
Ms. Schaubach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rudinovich, I don't know if I can answer that. It would seem that would be the case.
I can speak to that anecdotally. I don't have any specific numbers, but I know both my parents at a point in time were working minimum wage jobs, and we were receiving Minnesota Care, food stamps, reduced school lunches, and I think MFIP as well. So anecdotally, yes. If you have a wage that isn't being at a certain threshold, you're going to be relying on certain programs to make sure you're being fed, make sure you're healthy, and make sure your children are being cared for as well. So anecdotally, I think that's the case.
Thank you.
Rodinovich. All right, we'll go one more question, we're going to move to the next three testifiers. Go ahead, Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Ms. Schaubeck. You mentioned at the beginning of your testimony that most of your workers, being union members, don't make minimum wage, and so this is not an issue maybe that directly affects your members. But I wondered, I've been doing a little reading and understand that some collective bargaining agreements are pegged off of the minimum wage. And so could you comment on that? I mean, what, especially it's my understanding in the hospitality and service and some other industries, those agreements are pegged off of the minimum wage plus, you know, an amount above that. So could you comment on that and how that may impact other wages within the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Schaubeck?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, definitely. I would say that almost all wages are pegged off the minimum wage. And if you see in a business where, you know, somebody's been there for a long time and they're, you're going to see kind of a mild or, you know, minimal increase in folks all the way up the line in that business. And we don't see that as a bad thing. People nowadays need money in their pockets. The economy's been tough, and we know that the middle class really drives the economy, and we need to get Minnesota really moving again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next three, thank you for your testimony. The next three testifiers, just so you can plan ahead here, is Ben Gerber, Rob Hart, and Paul Rademacher. So if the three of you would prepare yourselves, and assuming you're coming individually, Ben Gerber, if you want to step up and start us off. And again, identify yourself for the record. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on labor issues. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is a organization of 2,400 large and small businesses across the state of Minnesota. 80% of our members have less than 20 employees, so we actually have a substantial number that are the small businesses. And which the reason I'm testifying here today is we believe that raising the minimum wage as proposed in House File 92 would have a extremely negative impact on employment and small as well as large businesses across the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start off by addressing some issues. I think it's important, and we've heard a lot of with President Obama's State of the Union address. You hear the two issues. I feel like they're discussed two very different issues that are discussed as one, which is the difference between a minimum wage and a living wage. I think they're two very different. They're two very different things. When the minimum wage was introduced in 1938, it was 25 cents an hour. And if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and use the CPI inflation adjuster, 25 cents in 1938 would equal 407 today. So we hear people saying it hasn't kept up with the CPI. Well, if you actually look at from the historical minimum wage, we're actually doing a lot better than that. So you can pick specific dates in history and you can find a better number, but I don't think that's the way that we should be looking at how we address wages in this state. So the next issue that I have is you hear a lot about we just heard from the previous testifiers specifically about executive compensation. I've yet to figure out how executive compensation will be impacted by raising the minimum wage. So I think that's another concern I have with the debate. I think if you look at what we're trying to do, and when I've been meeting with legislators and other people, you hear that we're trying to help people in poverty. And while I understand that's a valiant effort, 60% of the people living below the poverty line last year didn't work. So if you're not actually employed, receiving a higher wage or mandating a higher wage isn't going to actually raise you out of poverty. And this was according to a study done by Cornell and American University professors, found that the vast majority of people making the minimum wage, or with people making the minimum wage in it, live above the poverty line. The biggest issue from our perspective for employers, if that employers are faced with suddenly higher labor costs, they're either forced to reduce hours or employment, and thus take-home pay will decline. The economist writing in the Journal of Human Resources in 2005 found that the losers from a higher minimum wage are actually the people that you're trying to help because of the reduction in hours. I think what is most concerning of all is that in a tough economy, higher prices, which would be the likely result of a higher minimum wage, make it more difficult for businesses to thrive. So businesses are forced to provide the same service or product. Businesses are forced to provide the same product with less service. You might have already experienced this trend when you're checking out using automatic cash registers at the grocery store, bussing your own table at a restaurant, or bagging your own groceries or pumping your own gas. And this is going to be the effect of a higher minimum wage as proposed under this bill. You as a customer might enjoy the convenience, but it's a convenience that used to be part of somebody else's job. And I think that's important to recognize here. And I think our biggest concern from the Chamber's perspective and with employment is the impact on higher teen unemployment. If you look at, according to data available from the current population survey, which is a conglomeration of the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Census, Minnesota has a higher current teen unemployment rate than South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa. We're only doing slightly better than Wisconsin. But if you look at it overall, these numbers are extremely concerning for us. The minimum wage has always been a way, it has existed since 1938 to get young workers and less skilled workers into the workforce, to give them the experience and skills that are necessary so they can move up. I've worked a minimum more than one minimum wage job in my life, and and from my experience, I gained valuable skills that I could then use to go on and be productive and other jobs that I work. So I think it's important to focus on that. What we're doing is, by raising the wage in this manner, is taking away that opportunity for these young workers. Thank you very much.
Does that finish your testimony then? Yeah. Very good. We do have some questions, but we're going to do rest of our testifiers of this three first, and members, and we'll make sure we get to your questions. Mr. Hart, Rob Hart. Again, if you identify yourself for the record, and go ahead. And members or testifiers, again, trying to keep it to 3 minutes at a max would be great. Thank you.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning to discuss this important bill. My name, for the record, is Rob Hart. I am with Employer Solutions Staffing Group. We are a staffing company that works with client companies all across the metro, and we respectfully stand opposed to HF 92 as amended. The initial bill, HF 92, would have raised the minimum wage to only $7.50 per hour, which we saw as a reasonable increase. But the amended version increases it by over $2 an hour by August of this year, and all the way to $10.55 per hour by August of 2015. When all is said and done, this bill would in effect raise the minimum wage by over 70% of the current Minnesota rate and by almost 50% of the current federal level by August of 2015. An increase of this magnitude is unprecedented and unwarranted. And let us remember that this is a minimum wage discussion. This is not a living wage discussion. Discussion and testimony of earlier of turnover and livable wages was discussed, but minimum wage jobs are not meant to be lifelong careers. I also started out of college as a server in a restaurant, and even only 3 years ago, found myself back at a crux in my career, working as a temporary employee in these lower wage and minimum wage jobs. But I entered those jobs understanding this was not a career for me, but rather a filler while I quickly, due to lack of funds, figured out what my next steps were. This amended bill also includes the following verbiage, which was not in the initial bill. No employer may take action to displace an employee, including a partial displacement through a reduction in hours, wages, or employment benefits, in order to hire an employee at the wage authorized. Our question is, how does something like this get enforced? The very nature of the jobs that our temporary employees work does not guarantee them a certain number of hours every week. These hours regularly change from week to week, and there are employees coming and going on a regular basis. So the question is, every time one of our client companies has to decrease an employee's hours from week to week due to demand and so forth, will they now be forced to document and prove that it was not because someone was being hired at the new minimum wage? From our vantage point, this is an unreasonable clause and it should be removed. Also, this bill seeks to index minimum wage to inflation, but makes no allowance for decrease in times of deflation. Given the year-to-year volatility of the economy, this is also of concern to us. We think that the Minnesota legislature needs to understand some of the types of businesses we deal with as a staffing company. Oftentimes, these companies that seek us out are already struggling to trim costs and streamline revenue in order to make a profit. And now, the legislature would in effect add a $4.40 per hour per employee burden to their shoulders. Between the cost itself and the loss of ability to leverage resources and as needed on a week-by-week basis, is not unrealistic to say that this amended bill would inevitably put many companies, including some of our clients, at risk of having to close their doors.
You just have another minute or so here.
Okay. I am.
Finish here.
A minute will cover. At the end, results would be the opposite of what is trying to be achieved in this bill. Furthermore, this severe of an increase would inevitably have a ripple effect on those who are currently being paid just above minimum wage, with those employees understandably expecting to be paid proportionally, adding further severe burden to struggling employers. Now, our intention is not to come across as a cruel and uncompassionate employer, as we do not generally oppose an increase, but rather to request that the legislature take a more fair and more incremental approach when considering the dollar amount to establish the next minimum wage. And we believe that there's something to be learned from our neighboring states who have set the minimum wage to the federal minimum wage. This would surely be a more bearable and understandable increase. And there are certainly tax credits available as well. And the federal conformity is an approach that the Minnesota legislature has already taken when it comes to some tax and healthcare discussions, and believe should be considered as a potential alternative to such a severe increase. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Mr. Rademacher and Jamie Poole, I think, is going to join. And then members, after the testimony from these two people, will take time for questions from our last testifiers. And again, if you identify yourself for the record, and again, we really want to keep our time limited to just a couple minutes so everyone gets a chance to speak and our members get a chance to ask questions. So please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity. I will keep it very brief. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. Excuse me, and I'm here to speak in opposition of House File 92 as amended, or as will be amended. We are a state trade association for the grocers for over 115 years. We represent over 200 retail members with 1,100 locations. Our members employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. Minnesota is very, very fortunate that we have a unique culture with hundreds of small, independent, and locally owned grocers and convenience store operators. They are the cornerstones of their community. They create jobs, support local charities, and provide a safe, responsible shopping experience. The retail food industry is the backbone of the economy, providing one out of 20 jobs to our state. 80% of the grocery stores employ fewer than 50 workers. Grocery and convenience stores are more than just a retail outlet. Grocers employ young people looking for that first-time job. seniors looking for some additional spending income in their retirement, and developmentally challenged individuals looking for an opportunity. As a matter of fact, young workers ages 16 to 24 hold nearly one-third of grocery store jobs. However, this demographic, by law, cannot necessarily work early, work late. They can't work on ladders or in freezers or operate paper balers. They are a limited ability to employ. The trends of youth employment appear to be in serious jeopardy as well. Based on Deed statistics, the highest demographic that is unemployed in our state are the individuals between 16 to 19, nearly 20%. This is alarming, as an entire generation of Minnesotans are not being given the opportunity to gain valuable first-time employment experience. This legislation, unfortunately, would only exacerbate this problem. The retail food industry typically operates on margins that are around 1%. The increased payroll costs would severely affect the retail food industry's ability to succeed in this challenging marketplace. The formula required to maintain a viable business dictates the retail food industry's ability to cost shift. Nearly 40% increase over a two-year period in wages is not an absorbable expense. This unintended result will create higher food prices, less jobs, and a reduction of services. Additionally, the bill proposes a link to inflation, which is horrendously problematic. Recently, a retailer who operates here in Minnesota and in Florida, they increased their minimum wage and tied it to inflation. That retail grocer, over a two-year period, had a 20% reduction in employee count, and the employees that are left have seen a 3% reduction in hours worked, and that is unfortunately keeping up with the CPI index. The Minnesota retail food industry prides itself on offering wonderful jobs with good paying benefits, health care, sick time, and pension programs. Minnesota has one of the highest per capita incomes in the country at $44,650 a year. And part of this success can be attributed to the excellent careers the retail food industry provides. We are concerned with this proposed legislation and know it will be very detrimental to Minnesota's retail food industry. Our members have already begun reviewing their workforce and how to restructure to sustain their business models. This bill could eliminate entry-level jobs and create greater burden on all employees. We ask you to oppose this legislation and allow Minnesotans the opportunity to seek skill sets necessary to succeed in our workforce, as well as allow them the security and stability they need. That ends our testimony. I will certainly stand for questions.
Very good.
And
thank
I brought
your
grocer with, so thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Rademacher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Rademacher. I am currently a independent business owner in, we have four stores, one in Shakopee, one in Le Sueur, one in Le Center, and one in Jordan, Minnesota. We currently employ 330 union and non-union employees. Of the 330, 166 are currently non-union employees. The numbers I'm going to give you today are based on our actual employment. If the minimum wage were to increase tomorrow to $10.55, it would cost my company $464,798 a year. If you decrease that number to the $9.50, it takes the number to $337,000 per year. There are three ways for us to pay for that. We can either raise prices, which in the environment we're in right now is very difficult. We have competition from all around us. We have Walmart, we have Walgreens, we have Quick Trips, we have Costco's, all of the big players. Raising prices would make us less competitive against those competitors, as they have higher volumes and deeper pockets. Price increases would also reduce the buying power of the people that currently work for us and are currently paid the minimum wage. We can also cut the hours or cut the number of associates that work for us in order to pay for the increase in wages. The other thing we can do is we can cut capital investment in our business, which would hinder us from expanding, improving, or upgrading our current stores. Currently, we are spending about $360,000 in our business to upgrade our facilities to make them more efficient, and those are very capital intensive and require funds up front, funds that wouldn't be available under this. The other thing that I think is very important for you guys to understand is we are under incredible cost pressure from all around us. Currently, cost increases being proposed or signed into law that will affect our business include a $3.30 increase in the minimum wage, which is a 31% increase in our in the minimum wage. Our current minimum wage is $7.25, by the way. We follow the federal guidelines. 5.5% sales tax on business-to-business services that we use frequently, which include lawyer services and accountants. New federal tax rate of 39.6%. That would be taxed on individual earnings or S-corporations, which my company is. We also saw a 2% tax holiday not extended. The capital gains rate is going from 15 to 20%. There is a 3.8% tax on investment income through Obamacare that's down the pipe. We have also already put our W-2 additions through for our employees to pay taxes on their health benefits as they sit. And there's also a new state tax rate proposed right now of 9.85%, which would also affect us through the S-Corp. We also want to make sure you guys understand that the minimum wage is a starting wage. As an employer, we are always seeking qualified, hardworking, good employees. When they start out at the minimum wage, if they're exceeding, if they're very productive, they do not remain there for very long. We need to keep good people working for us, and we feel that the marketplace will dictate how those individuals are paid based on how productive they are. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony. We're going to take a stop for questions now. So if Mr. Gerber and Mr. Hart, I guess, and the two that just completed testimony will be available for questions. And just for planning purposes, the next three testifiers, so you're ready to go. And again, look at your testimony to keep it 3 minutes or less. Jessica English, Brian Payne, I think you have maybe a couple people with you. Jeff Lindo, so it'll be the next three up. But now to the legislators. Start with Representative Metza. The question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I can't look at you, Ben, to get the microphone record here. I just wanted to ask, you said that you're getting a bunch of life skills, you know, bagging groceries or pumping gas, working at McDonald's. How do those life skills get you a better job after? You know, for me, this isn't necessarily, when we're talking about the minimum wage increase, about dealing with people who are going to school, who are, you know, kind of stuck, I guess, in the mud. It's about people who have gotten to a point in their life where, you know, maybe things didn't pan out the way they wanted. They had kids early. You know, life brings you lots of surprises. To me, this discussion about minimum wage is making sure that those families, and again, we're not talking about a living wage, and we'd probably be hearing a lot more complaints about a $13 an hour conversation, but it's about raising the bar for those people and making sure that, you know, those who are making sure our day-to-day lives are easier. I know one of my favorite people back home I see every morning, her name's Barb, and she works at my Holiday gas station. And she's probably 55 years old, and basically she wants to be able to make enough to see her kids, see her family, and she was very happy that I was supporting minimum wage bills down here. So, I mean, I guess my question is, for those of people who don't have the, you know, wherewithal to get back to college to make their lives better, and we know that college isn't a fix-it-all right now for getting into workforce, why is it unfair to ask that we raise the bar a little for everyone?
Mr. Gerber, you want to take a shot at it?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Metza, thank you for the question. My response would be, part of what the Chamber has done is gone around the state and looked at workforce development. And one of the things that we hear consistently from businesses is not always that people are lacking the hard skills, which is the education, but a lot of times it's those soft skills, and it's how you deal with people and how you can interact with a boss and other people. And that's where, you know, you bring up the example of a gas station, you know, bagging groceries. You know, we need those jobs in our society. People, we have to do them, whether it's, you know, cleaning hotel rooms. I mean, it's a necessary part of the way we've set up our economy. And so that it allows you the opportunity to interact with people, to gain those soft skills, which are just as important in a lot of cases as the hard skills.
Very good. Representative Radinovich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the testifiers. I, you know, in full disclosure, am someone who supports raising the minimum wage. And I've heard a lot of discussion about low prices. And I have to admit that as a consumer, I'm probably not as conscientious as I should be about where I shop. I like low prices as much as anybody else, but I have to admit that when faced with the prospect, and directly so, that my low prices are predicated on holding the line on wages for the lowest paid workers in the state of Minnesota, it doesn't necessarily make me feel any better about that. So, I just want to make that comment, but also, as it relates to particularly the grocery store industry, there was discussion of how, I think you implied, Mr. Gerber, that as the minimum wage raises, you see people pumping their own gas, bagging their own groceries, other innovations like that. And I seem to remember there was a grocery store in Uptown where they have some of those things. We don't have them in Crosby-Arrington. We don't have the bag your own grocery aisles quite yet. We'll maybe get them in a few years. We're a little late up there usually. But there were four of them together, and then there was one worker who was supervising the four of them. And that seems to be an innovation that is directly linked to productivity, in that you can have one worker supervising four aisles and checkout. And on the Monday testimony, we heard that if minimum wage were linked to productivity, as it had been at least to some degree before, that it would be, in fact, much higher than the proposal that we have before us. So could you speak to me about the innovations we've seen in that have led to increased productivity, and why it is that some of those profits and some of those gains that we made have not gone to workers' salaries, particularly with the minimum wage?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Radinovich, my response to you would be, when you have increases in productivity, all those savings are going to be passed on to the ultimate consumer in the form of lower prices. So that's, I think that would be my answer.
Okay. Radinovich, follow?
Just one final comment. That would seem, again, I appreciate low prices, but it would seem to be an inequitable distribution of the fruits of our labor if the product, the benefits that we see are applied equally, as opposed to the targeted groups whose wages have been stagnant for so long. I mean, that's the very issue, this nature of this problem for me. So I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate your testimony.
Very good. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question would be for Mr. Gerber. I just want to double check, because I don't know if I heard his some stats he was quoting earlier correctly. Mr. Gerber, when you were talking about people who don't work, who live in poverty, you mentioned that figure was 60%. Is that correct?
Mr. Gerber?
Representative
Fisher.
Fisher, thank you. Yeah, it was 60% of the people classified by the census as poor don't currently work.
And
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerber, on that 60%, what percentage, how many of those are children?
This is,
and I'd be curious in what reports you're using, because I've seen different stats and different reports, and that's why I'm asking the question.
I believe
through the chair,
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, I believe it's people 16 and above, but I can get you. I'd be happy to provide that information.
I would be.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to see it, because some of the reports I've seen have been indicating that most of the people who are in poverty are usually children. I know that in the MPIB program, 4/5 of the people in that program are children. And these are usually children of parents who are in poverty, many of them who are working. And so, therefore, a raise in the minimum wage not only addresses the parents, but also helps the children who we've got that we're trying to address. So that would directly help those who are in the 60, many of those children who are down in that lower poverty range. I think this is something that is broader, and that's why I'm curious to see the stats and what your reports are citing.
Very good. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question eventually will get to Mr. Gerber, but I don't doubt the intentions of the author and the folks that support it. All of us want to see the citizens of Minnesota do better, regardless of the income scale. But I guess when I first came into this, I took it pretty seriously. This is more and more, especially with the delete all and the things that this is a show bill that I don't believe really has much of a chance. It's going to work its process through, but this would be the most irresponsible bill that we've passed to eventually help the people of Minnesota in the areas that we want to help. And the laws of supply and demand. I really only have one question, because I know we're going to have more economists that will come before, and that is, and it's been stated by a couple of the other testifiers, But, Mr. Gerber, I've gotten emails. I have the latest one from a guy who CEO of a restaurant chain, 61 stores, 3,700 employees. It emphatically says, in fact, that if we were to raise minimum wage to this level, that there's just one thing he could do, and that would be hopefully stay in business by laying people off. But at the worst and most probable is that just supply and demand. We'll have to raise prices so much that he won't be competitive and he'll go out of business. And so just to validate, so when faced with increased costs, what is the natural reaction by a business?
Mr. Gerber?
Sorry, I have a chair. Representative Benson, thank you. Sorry, I have a little cold. What you do is you have to cut costs or increase productivity. I've run a small business before. I ran an asphalt seal coating and paving business while I was in college, and if the price of asphalt coating went up, you end up having to absorb the cost. So I think it's frustrating from in the chamber is trying to educate legislators and that when prices go up, so wages or your products, you can't just pass on costs to the consumers. It doesn't work like that. So, and we heard that from one of the testifiers today. It's just not the reality.
Yeah, thank you. I have more questions, but they'll come later with the author. And
very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have four legislators still on board here, and we'll take those four, and then we'll move on to the next three testifiers, and we'll start with Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Rademacher. Mr. Rademacher, I think oftentimes there's a little misconception about just how much businesses make in terms of net profits and how difficult it is to compete, particularly in today's economy. You gave some good illustrations in terms of whether you take it and call it a 70% increase or the Minnesota rate, or how this affects your business in terms of what you would have to do, because obviously a 70% increase in your labor costs have to be picked up somewhere, because your margins are, and Ms. Poole testified, margins are 1 or 2% in the grocery industry. Many industries, margins might be a little better than that, 5 to 10%, but you're looking at a 70% increase in your human costs here. Now, what would you specifically do? How would it affect your business bottom line, and how would you plan for the future with something like this?
Mr. Rademacher?
How would it affect my bottom line? When we are faced with increased costs, be it labor or product costs, we have to figure out how to pass that along to consumer as best we possibly can. Right now we're in an extremely competitive environment, so raising prices is not necessarily going to do it. We're competing with Walmart and the other low-price competitors, and to the other representative's point, people do vote with their wallets every day. Walmart's the number one selling grocer in the country, so low prices do matter to most people. So we have to raise prices on the products we sell, and we have to cut expenses on our SG&A. We have to cut labor expenses. We have to scale back investment in our businesses. We have to scale back investment in new facilities. It affects every single thing we do. But to your point, we try and balance that as best we can to continue to prosper and grow our company. In our lower volume stores, the effect of this bill would be to, it could be to close one or two of those.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Just briefly.
Yes, Mr. Rademacher. You mentioned you pay the federal minimum wage in your business and everything else. Do you feel that as the economy improves, supply and demand as far as the employer workforce goes, that because of that, that you would end up paying higher prices than the minimum wage as time goes on?
Mr. Rademacher?
We already do. So, for instance, we hire most adults over the minimum wage. Different jobs in our store require different skills. Those skills pay more than jobs that require less skill. For instance, we're hiring people in our delis right now for $10 an hour. So
effectively, you're really already paying what this bill would provide to many of your employees.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you guys need to understand is the numbers I shared with you are numbers. It's not based on everyone going from 725 to 1055. It's based on from where they're at to getting to that 1055. So if an individual is making $10 an hour, they're going to get a 55-cent raise to get to the minimum wage. That exercise costs our company $465,000 per year.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. You know, we've been talking a lot about House File 92, but the delete all, but I'm confused. Have we substituted the delete all amendment? Because I'd like to hear testimony based on what bill we're actually working on. So can I get clarification, please, as to what we're actually working on?
This is a joint committee where we're just taking testimony on minimum wage, and tomorrow we're going to actually take up the bill.
So we will be doing the delete all amendment tomorrow?
That's correct.
Okay. So when we're having testimony today, then we are not talking about the bill in front of us, which is the 750, but in fact the 1055 index for inflation, plus saying that employers could not lay somebody off to be in compliance.
We'll be taking up the delete all tomorrow, but as testifiers come up, they can talk in general terms about their impact on raising the minimum wage, or they can address the bill, whatever they feel they wanted to testify to.
I see, but as a business owner, I think it's a big difference, as our grocer just pointed out, Paul, that there's a big difference between the original bill, 750, indexed for inflation, and brought all the way up to 1055, plus indexed for inflation, plus there's basically a mandate that you can't lay anybody off. That's a big difference, so I think we should probably know what we're talking about. Those two totally different bills.
So we'll be taking up the delete all tomorrow.
So then we should be, all the testimony should address the latter bill, the delete all then.
Yeah.
The 1055 plus index for inflation plus you can't lay anybody off. Okay, I just want to know what we're talking about. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what we're reading here is on the delete all on line 2.11, that refers to the training wage, the 90-day period, and that's what you can't lay somebody else off to hire somebody for 90 days. That's the way I read that. Ms. Newman could make sure I'm correct in my assumption, but that's what they're talking about here. It's not that you can't lay somebody off because the minimum wage goes up, but you can't lay somebody off and replace them with somebody for 90 days for the for the training wage.
Ms. Newman, did you want to
comment on that? Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that is correct. The wording on line 2.13, the reference to the wage authorized in this paragraph, means it's the language in paragraph C here.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So that's the training wage that you can hire somebody for 90 days for, so you don't have to pay them the full 90, the wage, and that's what that's talking about, not the total minimum wage bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Ms. Newman.
Nelson, that is correct. If you look up at the deleted language from the current law, that's the language already in current law.
Very good. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments and ultimately question will be directed to Mr. Gerber. I think that what's happening in some of the testimony that we're hearing is that there's some what I think is a false perception that folks that are making minimum wage out there are kids or students or people that don't have families or bills or insurance to pay or rent to pay or mortgages to pay, and I have to tell you that that's not true. I just came off an election a few months ago, which I knocked several thousand doors and met several thousand people in my district in West Duluth. And I can tell you that there's a lot of adults, there's a lot of families out there with children that are working very hard. And quite frankly, some of them are working these minimum wage jobs. Not necessarily because, excuse me, because they want to work minimum wage jobs. It's because that's what's out there. Or that happens to be what is paid at that particular job that they have. And frankly, they're happy to have jobs. So I don't buy into this concept that we're just really talking about kids that don't need a lot of money, because we are talking about adults with families. And I would encourage anybody that thinks otherwise to go out and spend, you know, an hour or a day or a week just talking to people in neighborhoods anywhere across the state and try to come to the conclusion that we're just talking about people that don't really need money. More and more adults, and we heard testimony yesterday, I think, more and more adults are in this situation where they're forced to work minimum wage or low wage jobs, and quite frankly, more and more of them have college educations, whether it be a 2-year or 4-year degree, and they can't find work in their chosen field, or for whatever reason they're in between jobs and they're working these low wage jobs. But I want to focus in on a number, and I appreciate, Mr. Chair, that we're just having an open hearing and a discussion about minimum wage, and I appreciate that. But I'm just going to pick a number that's easy to work with because it's round, and it's $10 an hour. Now, if a person works full-time at $10 an hour, you will roughly make just over $1,700 per month gross, right? And out of that $1,700 gross per month, you will be expected to pay tax to the federal government, to the state government. Out of that $1,700 a month, you'll be expected to pay some form of health insurance premium. And if you happen to have a family, that's going to eat up most of it, quite frankly. But let's say you're single, maybe you're paying $500. That leaves you about $1,200 of income per month. Out of that $1,200, we expect you to be a functional member of society. We expect you to, you know, pay rent or pay a mortgage. We expect you to eat, right? Got to have food, clothe yourselves, have a vehicle perhaps to get back and forth to work, buy fuel, pay for utilities, educate your children, do all the things that all of us do on a day-to-day basis that cost money. And we're going to do that on $1,200 a month. And that's assuming we pay them $10 an hour, not $7 in some sense. But my question, and I want to make sure that I heard you, because this is an important piece to me, but in response to another representative's question, I think what you said was, what we need is people to clean hotel rooms, or something to that effect. Are you suggesting that these folks don't deserve an increase in the minimum wage? That's my really question. And we can focus in on that group or any particular group that you want. But are you telling me in your testimony that you don't believe that these folks deserve an increase in the minimum wage? Thank you.
Mr. Gerber?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Simonson, to answer your question, you know, I think there's this perception out there that people also stay at minimum wage jobs forever and they never get a raise. Two-thirds of people that start a minimum wage job get a raise within a year. So, and that's going to vary by industry as well. So that should be the business's decision whether they want to raise the wage or not. I don't think the legislature should tell the business that they are required to give somebody a raise.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Briefly.
I'm not going to take up any more of the committee's time, but I just want to make a final comment that when and if we raise this minimum wage, and when and if these employees that do good work for relatively low dollars, let's make sure that we have an understanding that the dollars that we give them, whether it's $2 or $1 or $3 or $4 more per hour, they're not going to put it in their savings account. They're not going to take it and go on vacations to Florida. They're not going to go to California. They're going to spend money right here in Minnesota at your businesses, the folks that you represent, and they're going to try to live normal lives. So in full transparency, I'll be supporting this bill when we get to it. Thank you.
Very good. And we got one more question from Representative Loon. Then we're going to move on to the next testifiers. And if members could hold off to the next group, that'd be great. Representative Loon?
Could I respond to the representative?
Certainly. Go ahead.
You know, the raising the minimum wage to $10 an hour, assuming the $1,200 a week that
figure that you came up with does not take into account that everything that that individual purchases will also go up in price. The food that he purchases, the fuel that he purchases, the energy costs, everything will go up in price. The price of labor will go up. The cost of the businesses will go up, and those prices will also go up. So his buying power at that $10 an hour will remain essentially the same.
Very good. Rep. Sam Bloom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to thank the testifier, Mr. Rademacher, for making that point, because I don't think anyone here is opposed to fairness, and we could all look at what people are paid, and a case could be made that, gee, they work really hard, maybe it's not fair. What we're trying to, I think, draw out is that there are consequences, and some very severe consequences, to making a change like this and a significant increase, and that what will those consequences be? And the concern is reduced employment opportunities for people who perhaps most need the opportunity to have maybe their first job or to get into the workforce. So I'm going to ask this to Mr. Gerber, but if anybody else wants to hop in or look at this, I've been looking at some of the reports that are available and looking at who makes minimum wage in Minnesota and what we're talking about. So, in response to one of the other members' comments about who makes minimum wage, the information I have from the Department of Labor and Industry is fully that 60% of the people making minimum wage in Minnesota are young people, age 24 or under. And in fact, most of them are age 15 to 19. So we are talking about teenagers, presumably living at home. And that of people over age 25, from age 25 to 54, we're talking about 3.2% of the workforce making minimum wage. So I just wanted to get that on the record, because I think it's important to have those statistics, to have our discussion. And Mr. Gerber, in looking at some of the studies, I think you mentioned the one from Cornell and perhaps American University, but what percentage of the net benefit of a minimum wage increase goes to people living at or below the federal poverty level?
Mr.
So
Gerber?
What does this do for people who, you know, really are kind of at the very bottom of our earnings that we would be hoping to help?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, are you asking specifically what the benefit that they'll give back to the community, or the benefit that they would receive?
Rep. Sam Bloom?
Well, I'm wondering what of the people living at that at or below the poverty level, how many of them would actually be helped, whether it's they actually get an increase in their income level through a minimum wage increase.
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the numbers that I have that I could cite to you from one of these studies. So if you took an increase in the minimum wage from $7.25, which is the federal, to $9.50 per hour, only 11.3% of workers will gain from an increase to that $9.50. only 11.3% of those that will gain will actually be living in poor households. Of those who will gain, 63.2% are second or third earners living in households with incomes twice the poverty line, and 42.3% live in households with incomes three times the poverty line.
Very good. Last comment? Is that it?
I'll suspend for now. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Okay.
And I apologize, Mr. Chair. May I offer a response to the Representative Radinovich's
comments? We need to move on at this point, unless it's really brief.
It is rather brief. He made the, as part of his question to Mr. Gerber, he made the statement that if minimum wage were currently priced, inflation, it would be much higher than what's being proposed. And I would, in all due respect, request to know what that amount reflects from his research. Because according to inflation, if it were the minimum wage were currently what it was back to around 1974, as of 2011, it would only be $8.36 an hour. And so President Obama's proposal of $9 an hour would actually place it ahead of inflation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And we have a few people left here who are not going to be able to make it this evening, so we're going to, if you would step up, Ms. English, Brian Payne, Jeff Lindell, and then there's three others, Jason Atkins, Reverend Chamberlain, and Mr. Rushy. If you want to come on down, we have about 20 minutes. I'd like to get the testimony from you folks done in close to 10 minutes or so, so you really need to keep it brief because we want opportunity for legislators to engage in what you have to say. So brevity, I'm going to have to break in if it gets too long for you. So if you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Jessica English. I'm 34. I'm a single mom of four incredible daughters. I'm a student at Normandale Community College, and I'm a person who has worked for 15 years for minimum wage. The one thing that I would like you to remember about me is that there are not enough hours for me to work in a day to afford basic needs, housing, transportation, food, clothing, and medical care. After over a decade of juggling bills and borrowing money from my friends, I am homeless. If I continue to work for these wages, there is no end in sight. I work, I go to school, stay up till 3 a.m. writing papers. When am I supposed to spend time with my kids? When can I volunteer in their school? When do I have time to be involved in politics? Someone needs to do the math. Not the math of making more profits, not the math for the shareholders, but the math of real families and the real cost of living. The math of the 29 to 39,000 children in this state who do not have a permanent home. The minimum wage is a reflection of what we value. On behalf of me and my family and my children, my kids, who I don't get to see every day, please raise the minimum wage. Please put higher value on my work and my family.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And to the next testifier, if you identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chairman Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Jeff Lindu. I am a pharmacist, Vice President of Governmental and Regulatory Affairs for Thrifty White Pharmacy, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Thrifty White is an employee-owned company based here in the Twin Cities. We operate 50 pharmacies in Minnesota, virtually all in rural communities. We employ about 1,000 people in Minnesota, 650 of which are employee owners. The marketplace has developed a very wide range of salaries in our pharmacies. We pay salaries from minimum wage to the salary of a licensed healthcare professional. In our rural communities, we compete with hardware stores, grocery stores, convenience stores, and McDonald's. In our rural communities, we compete with hardware stores, grocery stores, convenience stores, and McDonald's for many of our employees. The employees who join our company at minimum wage today are most often individuals who are just entering the job market. They may be high school students or a mother whose children are in school and wants to enter the job market for the first time. We're training these individuals not in technical skills of the job, but in basic job skills. If all goes well, they soon assume additional responsibilities and a higher salary. Today, with 50 pharmacies in Minnesota, we have 46 employees in Minnesota below $7.50 an hour. Virtually all are part-time or temporary. Some are new hires. Many are students for whom we accommodate class, test, holiday, break schedules. Others are retirees who deliver prescriptions for us a couple days a week. In order to accommodate the special situations of these employees, we need the flexibility to pay a lower salary. Without that flexibility, I'd have to say job opportunities for many of these individuals would disappear. Experience required would likely become part of the job list. We have approximately 100 additional employees below $9.25 an hour. Again, the vast majority are students or other individuals with limitations on their work schedules. The flexibility for us to pay a lower salary makes it worthwhile to accommodate the scheduling limitations.
And then just to wind up in the next.
We believe the free market system has worked as it's supposed to with salaries in Minnesota. Individuals with the desire and skills to earn a living wage have the opportunity in our organization to do so, even in rural communities. Individuals who have limitations on their availability for work or who have not yet developed basic job skills have opportunities to enter the job market, develop skills, and move up in salary or remain in the limited position that they desire. Thank you very much. I'd be glad to answer
questions. Thank you for your testimony. And if Mr. Payne and Mr. Atkins would step up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Payne, and I will be here also translating for two members of our organization, the Center of Workers United in Struggle.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes, so
okay.
Please identify yourself for your record and with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Brian Payne. I work with CTUL. We partner with low-wage workers who are organizing for fair wages and fair working conditions in the Twin Cities. Workers who come from temp agencies, from service sector jobs and construction, are making around minimum wage and around the minimum wage level, who are the people who are coming to the center. We're particularly working and organizing with retail janitors who are contracted out to clean Target and other stores in the Twin Cities metro area. And the irony of what these workers are seeing is that every night when they're working, they're surrounded by food, they're surrounded by products, and they cannot afford to even put food on the plates of their own families when they're surrounded and seeing all this food all night cleaning. I'd like to translate for two of our members who will talk about their own experience.
Hi, my name is Gerania. Yo trabajé para una temporaria por tres años con el sueldo mínimo de $7.25.
My name is Gerania. I worked for a temp agency and working at the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour for 3 years.
Y en la temporaria nos enviaba para una compañía que tenía trabajadores tenían hasta 10 años ganando $7.25 por hora.
The temp agency sent us to a place where we were working where a number of workers had worked up to 10 years making the minimum wage without a raise ever.
Esto me impactó a mí mucho porque ni siquiera nos daban las 40 horas y yo pagaba niñera, babysitter, en total eran $250 por semana y 150 eran para la niñera.
This impacts me greatly because they weren't giving us the full 40 hours, but I had to pay for child care. So I was paying $250 per week just for child care.
Mi esposo tenía dos trabajos ganando poquito más del sueldo mínimo.
My husband had to work two jobs, just barely making a little bit more than minimum wage.
Después yo me separé de mi esposo y tuve que buscar un trabajo en la noche a veces.
And then when I separated from my husband and became a single mother, I had to start looking for a second job working at night to be able to get by.
Y tuve que luchar para que aumentaran los salarios también en esta compañía.
And we had to struggle just to be able to finally get a raise after a long time at that company.
Y para mí es una pena y una vergüenza que grandes ejecutivos y dueños de temporarias ganan miles de dólares por hora mientras yo no tenía para comprarles ropa a mis hijos.
For me, it's a shame to see that the CEOs of some of the large companies in Minnesota are making thousands of dollars per hour while I can barely even scrape by to put food on the plates for my children.
And just want to make sure tuve que pedir apoyo económico al gobierno de food stamps.
Very good. I want to make sure Jose gets a chance to speak as well, and then we need to wind up.
I ended up having to ask for support from the government through food stamps just to be able to get by.
Muy buenos días. Mi nombre es José Fernández y soy miembro de CETUL.
Good morning. My name is José Fernández and I'm a member of CETUL.
Le doy gracias por dar esta oportunidad para expresar mis sentimientos a nombre de la comunidad latina.
I thank you for the opportunity to be able to express my opinions in the name of the Latino community.
Que sea posible de que nos mejoraran el sueldo, ya que todos estamos ganando entre los 6.25 hasta 8.50 la hora, y mínimo y máximo de 25 a 30 horas por semana.
We support raising the minimum wage, where we see so many people who are making between $7.25 to $8.50 an hour, and often aren't able to get the full 40 hours, only 20 to 25 hours.
En la limpieza de restaurantes, limpieza de hoteles, y en los restaurantes es casi el mismo nivel de sueldo.
I've worked in the cleaning of restaurants, I've worked at cleaning in hotels, I've worked in the back of restaurants, and almost all of those jobs making minimum wage.
Pido de favor que si es posible de nivelar, de subir un poquito más el sueldo, ya que nuestra economía es sumamente deficiente. Por esa razón hemos perdido las casas, no tenemos a dónde vivir, no podemos dar una educación suficiente a nuestros hijos.
We ask that the minimum wage would be raised so that we can be able to get by. We don't make enough to be able to provide for our families, to pay for rent, for our families to be able to survive. We ask that there would be an increase in the minimum wage.
Muchas gracias por haber dado atención a mis peticiones y a la de mis compañeros.
Thank you for taking the time to hear our requests of ourselves and our co-workers.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And lastly, Mr. Rushi and Ms. Chamberlain. And Mr. Atkins. And you have 3 or 4 minutes here, and then we want to make sure the legislators have a chance to ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll go from there.
Brian Rushi with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and let me immediately turn it over to Mr. Jason Atkins from the Minnesota Catholic Conference.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jason Adkins, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I'm here today to support an increase in the minimum wage. Catholic teaching emphasizes both a person's right to work and a responsibility to work. That work, however, must be remunerated by just wages that provide access to the basic necessities of the person and his or her family. When civil society fails to provide access to just wages for all persons, the state, an instrument of justice, in this case economic justice, may set a minimum wage. The church's experience indicates that people want to work, especially when they can look forward to fair wages, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. We believe that the enactment of a minimum wage increase in Minnesota could provide a major lift to low-income working families. Doing so will help restore work as a way out of poverty, a centerpiece recommendation of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty, an initiative which had its origins in local faith leaders' discussions, including the state's Catholic bishops. The bishops of Minnesota don't pretend to be economists, but they are pastors, and the church does oversee the largest non-governmental network of health, education, and charitable ministries in the state. What we can tell you from firsthand experience is that it is becoming increasingly difficult for the working poor of our state to make ends meet. If the minimum wage were increased to $9.50 an hour, for example, families of seven or fewer would rise above the federal poverty guidelines if both parents work 40 hours. The minimum wage should keep pace with inflation, match increases in the cost of living, and ensure families are able to pay for basic needs. By no means do we question the intentions or motivations of our good friends in the legislature who oppose an increase in the minimum wage, and we believe that the considerations of small businesses are especially important. But it is our hope and our prayer that the two sides could come together for some sort of action to address the grave problems facing the lowest wage earners in our state. We believe an increase in the minimum wage is a matter of fairness and justice, and we hope it can be addressed soon. We urge continued consideration of these and other ways compatible with a healthy economy to enhance workers' incomes. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Chamberlain, if you identify yourself and give some very brief testimony.
I'm the Reverend Canon Peg Chamberlain. I grew up in Carver County, Minnesota, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Churches. Minnesota Council of Churches consists of the leaders of about 1 million Christians in this state, 6 Lutheran bishops, a Methodist bishop, an Episcopal bishop, ELC, UCC, Presbyterian, you get the picture. We agree with the Minnesota Catholic Conference on this very issue, and on our work together through the JRLC, hope that you will indeed see fit to do what needs to be done around raising the minimum wage. This is the moral cost of doing business in Minnesota. The adequate minimum wage is a bedrock moral value for our life and community. We believe that human beings, each of us, are made in the image of God, and in our relationship with each other, we reflect the relationship of the Holy One. That is, each human being has an inherent dignity. I don't think any of us would disagree about that. Each one in our working expresses in some way that dignity, and as a community, we need to offer at least the barest minimum respect back to that effort. Where this legislature sets the minimum wage reflects what our society will claim for around the dignity of each of our brothers and sisters in their work. Work we need done. Where this legislature sets the minimum wage reflects whether our society truly believes that workers deserve at least a minimum wage for an hour's work, a wage which can indeed offset the basic needs towards food, shelter, and health care.
And we need to kind of wind it up because there might be some questions.
I will, thank you. This minimum wage won't do that, but it is at least a step in the right direction. And for too long, minimum wage has not provided even a minimally adequate standard of living. We experience that results in our, those results of that in our communities, where a growing number of hardworking men and women are turning up at our food banks, our food shelves, our soup kitchens, and even our homeless shelters, because they cannot feed and clothe and provide health care and house their children.
And just a final comment then, Mr. Chairman.
It's immoral that the minimum wage is worth less now than it was the year that Reverend Martin, Dr. Luther King, was killed in Memphis while fighting for living wages for sanitation workers. The eroded value of the minimum wage has reinforced growing inequality, which undermines our communities, our economy, and our democracy. It is the moral cost of doing business here in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Ruscha, I did want to allow some comments from legislators. Do you have anything you want to add that hasn't been said?
No, it's been said very well. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much. And members, we have just a few minutes, so if someone does have questions or comments, we'll make sure you have the opportunity to take this opportunity. Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but it's more for Mr. Payne and the lady and gentleman that were with him that don't speak English. I had a couple questions for the lady and gentleman. I didn't catch the lady's name. I heard Jose, but...
Herania?
Herania?
Herania Mata.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Herania, gracias, bienvenidos. Do the people that you work with who never got a raise in 10 years, do they understand that maybe they should ask? And I know that sometimes there's cultural barriers where you don't want to confront authority, but sometimes you need to ask for the raise or the job performance review.
Herania Mata.
Sí, ellos por mucho tiempo pidieron aumento y no la temporaria no les daba y la compañía tampoco.
Yes, they asked for a raise for many years, the whole time they worked there, but the temp agency didn't want to give them a raise.
Okay. Y después sí luchamos por un aumento y dieron un dólar solamente.
Okay. It was only when we organized together and all of us together collectively we were able to win a raise.
Okay, thank you.
Upstairs, keeper.
And Jose mentioned the restaurant industry, and I wondered if he's aware of the tiered tip credit type issue, because what's going to happen is as costs increase in the restaurant business and the customer interface is kind of the front of the shop side, that cost could be pushed and actually hurt the back of the shop side, the cooks, the cleaning people. Thank you.
Jose?
Sí, en cuanto en los trabajos de restaurantes, el que trabaja más es el preparador, el dishwasher, y no recibe propinas.
In restaurants, the people that work the hardest are often in the kitchen doing the preparation work, and the cooks, and don't get tips.
Right.
Very good.
Follow-up, or just want to make sure. Oh, do you have another question?
Yeah. Okay. Last one from Representative Lane here, because we will be getting together tonight. But Representative Lane, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clear up something before we left that Representative Loom had read from, I believe, the minimum wage report from Dolly. That's she said something about 3.2% of the people earning minimum wage were 25 to 54 years of age. But in fact, I think she read from the wrong column. And one third of those who get the minimum wage are workers that are 25 to 54 years of age. So I just wanted to clear that up.
Thank you very much, Representative Lane. Members, what we're going to do is be in recess till 6 o'clock.
I'm sorry.
Representative O'Neill, briefly?
Just, and maybe we could have Representative Loon speak to that, but that's not what she said.
Did you have something to say, Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, yes, what I was trying to communicate, and I apologize if I misspoke, but it's 3.2% of the entire workforce.
Okay.
That age category.
Very good. Thank you. What we're going to do, members and testifiers, we're going to be in recess till 6 o'clock tonight. We're going to reconvene in room 5, and we won't be in quite as hectic a pace at that time, so because we'll have a little bit more time. But thank you, everyone, for showing up. Again, we're in recess till that time. Thank you very much. We're going to start a little bit after 6, and... we're going to get moving here. Just a reminder, we're going to go 3 testifiers and then take a little break and give chance for legislators to ask questions as they feel they want to. We'll be hearing the bill tomorrow, and it's the delete all that we'll hear. Just be clear on that point, and we'll be voting on that bill sometime during that hour. And to start things off, we have... King Banyan, Mike Hickey, and Melvin Carter. I know some people have some time restraints tonight, so if you three want to, Mr. Carter, if you want to start right up, and the other two, just follow him right up after him. You know, however you want to handle it, be fine. But Councilmember Carter, if you want to identify yourself for the record. And
yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, good evening. My name is Melvin Carter, and I represent Ward 1 on the St. Paul City Council. I'm here today in support of the current proposal to raise the state's minimum wage. As you know, our minimum wage remains today at the rate this body set in 2005. Since that time, the Consumer Price Index shows total inflation of 18%. To state the obvious, an 18% increase in expenses with no additional income would challenge any family, but even that doesn't tell the whole story because in that same time, so many critical household expenses rose even more. The price of milk, according to the USDA, has risen by 36% a year at the University of Minnesota, 61%, and we all know gas has nearly doubled in that time. Because Minnesota families can do so much less with their money today, local governments are having to do more. For the city of St. Paul, that means additional public costs to prevent foreclosures, to monitor vacant buildings, to retrain workers, and to add capacity to serve families for whom our libraries and rec centers are the only affordable child care available to their family. Our late Senator Paul Wellstone once famously said, "We all do better when we all do better." In that spirit, the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act is in place, quote, to establish compensation standards that maintain workers' health, efficiency, and general well-being. A minimum wage that denies a full-time worker the chance to lift his or her family above the poverty line fails that test and threatens local economies. The neighborhoods I represent in Ward 1 are among our state's hardest hit by this economic crisis. Between 1999 and 2009, the median income in St. Paul's Frogtown neighborhood fell by 20%, from $35,800 to $28,800. In that same year, nearly one-third of Frogtown workers reported earning less than $1,250 per month, or $15,000 per year, leaving our neighborhood's poverty rate at a crippling 41.1%. Within a short walk from this building, I could introduce you to countless men and women who, despite working 8 to 10 hours a day for a company whose executive pay has never been higher, can barely afford to keep a roof over their head or food in their stomach. That's not the Minnesotan way, and it can't be now. Your support for this bill will mean increased wages for 500,000 hardworking Minnesotans, making them less likely to have to rely on public assistance to make ends meet and better equipped to contribute to Minnesota's economic recovery. My constituents and all of yours deserve better. Please support this bill and declare as a state what President Obama has challenged our nation to assert, that no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Councilmember Carter. And if you could stick around for a few minutes in case members have testimony or questions. Mr. Hickey and Mr. Banyu can share the table up there together. And for the testifiers, again, if we could keep our testimony to 3 minutes or so, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again. For the record, I'm King Banyan, Professor of Economics, St. Cloud State University, Senior Fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this issue. I feel like I'm getting a chance to go back to class again and talk about something that I've talked with students at St. Cloud State since 1984 and have enjoyed doing. This morning, in your you would have received a copy of our report that Representative Winkler is holding up for us. Thank you, sir. I would just call your attention to it and just make a few brief points and allow the report to speak for the rest of it. I would encourage you. I believe you were planning this morning, Mr. Chairman, to hear testimony from Mr. Rakowski from the Department of Labor and Industry. I hope he'll still be having a chance to speak to you. There is a minimum wage study that I encourage you to read that shows that 93,000 workers currently make the minimum wage in Minnesota. In the period of that study, many of them work part time. 60% of them are under age 25. Many of them will work part-time, will work a minimum wage job only for a little while, and then move on to something else. So dynamics in this case matter. But what I really wanted to mention to you is that I believe I've seen some of the information you received on Monday from your experts that you had come testify to you. And I wanted to remind you of the textbook story, because sometimes when you hear a bunch of economists, as I am, they can get you a little confused. And I think one of the ways, so I want you to go back just to your basic principles class, and I'll bet most of the members around this table took principles of economics at some point. If you raise the price of something, you will get more quantity supplied and less quantity demanded. It doesn't matter if it's milk, fish, or workers. That's what happens. So there will be some disemployment effect. Now, it could be relatively small, and what I do in this report that you have is try to review some of that data. But I think you should be careful in reading the information for two different reasons. One, the statistics that are being discussed come from a variety of different studies constructed in a variety of different ways. You heard testimony, I believe, on Monday about meta-studies, meta-analyses. I can tell you that among economists, meta-analyses tend to have some controversy around them. They're not necessarily something that's considered a standard within the profession, but I understand you heard a couple of them. It has been difficult for people to replicate the types of studies such as the Cardin-Kruger study that I know both of your testifiers Monday spoke to. And there's a long argument about that. In the report, I try to go through what those studies have shown for you and suggest to you that there is a disemployment effect. Some people will lose jobs. But that's really not the biggest part of this. The biggest part of this is it runs on two lines. One, it's not just the job, that not just whether or not you have a job, that's a condition of your employment. You're going to have fewer hours. Sure, that's true. But you might have fewer breaks. You might not get vacations. You might not get training. You might have to pay for your uniform that you have to wear on that job, okay, if you worked at the McDonald's or someplace like that. There are all other kinds of ways in which jobs can change. it might be that they turn down the heat in the winter and turn down the and leave the AC off in the summer. That's a way in which your job can change to try to make up for the money that's going to be paid. So your conditions of your work are going to be difficult. And then, but the second part, which I think is really interesting, I talked about a couple studies in this report, is that you have a number of places in which you have a number of studies that show a decrease in long-term wages. I was blessed at some point for someone to actually say, you know, you little kid, you can go behind the cash register and take 69 cents for a half gallon of skim milk at this Cumberland Farms and back in Manchester, New Hampshire, where I grew up. And, you know, it wasn't about learning how to make change. It was about learning to show up to work on time, keeping your hair cut, keeping your facial hair. I did have facial hair when I was in college, but keeping a little on the trim side, and so on. Learning those soft skills are what's important. If we do have an impact on the hiring rate of people, the growth rate slowing down for young people, it has a tremendous impact, not just on their employment in this particular year, but on their lifetime earnings. And frankly, the studies haven't done that for you. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I am done, and thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Hickey, if you would represent yourself to the committee, identify yourself for the record, and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. So we represent 13,000 small businesses across the state, and we're definitely a group affected by this and have members that do pay the minimum wage and would have to deal with this large increase. It comes as no surprise. We are strongly opposed to this very large increase in the minimum wage. And I just wanted to share a couple stats with you about who does earn the minimum wage. And I know you're hearing a lot of stats, but I'll be brief with it. 69% of workers earning the minimum wage are part-time, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. 53% of minimum wage earners are under 25. Another stat, only 21% of minimum wage workers are head of a household. Another stat, 56% come from a family that has an income that is 200% above the federal poverty guideline. And finally, the average family income of a minimum wage worker is $49,885. And I think what these stats tell us, despite what the advocates might say, is that the vast majority are young. The majority are young. The vast majority are working part-time jobs, and the vast majority are not the head of a household. This is a transitional wage. It's a wage you start at. Hopefully you move up quick, but it's never intended to be a livable wage. It's a wage that people get started on and hopefully don't spend a lot of time on it, and I think it's important to focus on that. And our concern is when we get to a level as high as $10.55, we really believe job opportunities are going to disappear, especially for young people. Is a business owner going to hire a very young person who's done virtually nothing in their life, $10.55 an hour, and have to give them constant supervision for $10.55 an hour? And I think a lot of business owners will not do that. They're going to say, this is not a decision I want to make. I'm going to find another way to meet my labor needs. Finally, we're very opposed to the escalator provision in this law. We realize that from time to time, the legislature and the Congress is going to act on a minimum wage increase, and you're definitely going to do it this year. But putting it on autopilot, putting it on an escalator, could bring all kinds of unintended consequences. The United States debt situation continues to worsen. We could go into a period of inflation as a reaction to the problems we're causing for ourselves, possibly a period of hyperinflation. And if we have a minimum wage pegged to that, who knows where the wage would be after a period of that, and if this country really experiences some difficulties that none of us want it to experience. But where could the minimum wage go on a scenario like that, and what would the job loss be if we have a minimum wage in the 10-plus, 11-plus, 12-plus hour range? And so for a lot of reasons, that's a bad policy. This is something you guys need to act on from time to time. Clearly, you're going to do it this year and revisit it in other years, and especially urge you to delete that provision from the bill as it makes its way through the process, and thanks for the time.
And thank you very much for your testimony. I know we have a couple questions. Appreciate you sticking around. I will start with Representative Benson.
Councilman Carter, please. Mr. Chair.
Councilmember Carter, if you'd join us. Representative Benson.
Councilman Carter, I just
myself been, since we started this deliberation, have been made aware of a number of studies, but I wondered if you'd been made aware of a study called Unequal Harm, Racial Disparities in the Employment Consequences of Minimum Wage Increases. It was just published in 2011. The researchers' name are Evan and McPherson. But I'll just read you a few of these and have you comment after I'm done. But it studied 600,000 data observations from 1994 to 2010, including an unprecedented sample of minority adults. And some of those stats that I think would be particularly interesting for you and and I'm sure you know many of the people that you represent and want to help. But among 16 to 24-year-old males without a high school diploma, each 10% increase in the minimum wage decreased employment by 2.5%. Now, that's national. That's all across all demographics, but from 16 to 24, male, female. But particularly when it comes to Hispanic males and black males, so from minorities, and that's the data point information, there was a 1.2% decrease for every 10% increase, but there was a 6.5% decrease for every 10% increase. So, and some of the bills that we're looking at are before us. We're looking at 30 to 50% increase, depending where you start from. But if you go from the federal minimum to to 1055, we could be looking at a 19% increase in unemployment. The national effect from 2007 to 2010, the minimum wage increases on 16 to 24-year-olds without high school education or diploma. For whites, there was a 6% decrease attributable to the minimum wage. To black males, 20% decrease attributed to the minimum wage increase. And I said this before to all of us, actually, and it was not just the people that will have a vote later on about whether we pass this or not, but actually the people in the crowd. But, you know, I don't deny that the legislation is designed to help a population and to improve the economically disadvantaged. But this is not the way to go about. There's just way too many data points, statistics, economic studies. I teach Economics 101 to point to that this is going to have a terribly negative effect on your community. And so it's a rhetorical question, but just to, the fact, are you aware of those kinds of statistics?
Representative Councilmember Carter, would you like to respond to Representative Benson's?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I would love to respond. I don't take it as a rhetorical question at all. I appreciate the reminder of our state's nation-leading disparities in unemployment, that we have a higher disparity, particularly among African-American men and white men in unemployment than any other major metropolitan area in our country. I do not take those disparities and all of the things that feed them as a constant. I think those are definitely things we ought to be pursuing as well. In the Twin Cities metro area, African-American man experiences unemployment three times the rate of our white community here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I appreciate the acknowledgement of those disparities, and I think we have a whole lot we ought to do to attack the disparities that exist in education and the criminal justice system and all over the board, so that when we see those types of things, there's an old saying in the African-American community that when America catches a cold, the African-American community catches the flu. That's something I would love to see this committee and this body take up as well, but I don't think that's a reason to say that we should not raise wages because we think that the compound effect that would have with the institutional racism that makes situations worse in the African American community might make things even worse than it was in the first place.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Benson, briefly?
Yeah, thank you. Councilman Carter, I'm afraid that based on these statistics with where you would want to go with the minimum wage, your community is going to catch pneumonia, not the flu. So that's my worry. I mean, I don't doubt that it's well-intended, the best intentions at all. However, this isn't the way to go about doing it. I mean, there's many other things that we should be helping your community with, but raising the minimum wage from 7 1/4 to 10.55 is not going to help. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, there's just a little bit of kind of cross-testimony taking place here, and I think it's just helpful to consider the differences. A lot of the testimony from Representative Banyan and Mr. Hickey relate to who currently is making the minimum wage. And at the same time, the economists who came in on Monday were talking about what would happen if you raised the minimum wage to a higher level and the number of people who are affected by it. So it's just, I think, important to remember that if you actually look at low-wage workers, who all would have some impact in increased wages, they are all benefiting from this. So if you're talking about people with less than $10 an hour, actually something like 60% of them are over the age of 25. Almost all of them have more than a high school diploma. So their point was that they're better educated and they're much older than the typical thought about minimum wage. And so I'm not trying to make too much of an editorial comment except to say that we're kind of talking about two different things. We're comparing people who currently make the minimum wage of $7.50 or whatever it is, seven, not much an hour, compared with people who would be making more if we raise the minimum wage. And so the data is not totally inconsistent. We're just going about looking at it in a slightly different way. And council member, I hope to see you on the hockey rink again sometime soon.
Absolutely.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this gets to a little bit what Representative Winkler was saying, is when Representative Benson is referring to a report that was covering a time range from 2007 to 2011, we had the Great Recession going on, where many of the jobs that were being referenced there were being held by people who had families. I work in a homeless youth community. I was in a homeless youth shelter working with the minority population at that point in time. Most of our youth could not get jobs for almost a year straight because those jobs were being filled by people that were my age or older because they needed that job to support their families. And thank God at least they had minimum wage, and I wish the minimum wage would have been higher because in down times, it's people like us who are supporting families who start losing our regular jobs and start taking any other job there is. And what it does, it ends up having a disproportionate impact on the youth population. And that's why we see some of those figures skewing the way they did during the Great Depression. So I think it's very important we keep that in mind and why we need to advocate for a better minimum wage going forward.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Fisher and Winkler. I made that point actually with the economists yesterday regarding the difference between cherry picking numbers and starting those numbers before the recession started, and again in 2011. But I did mention before I started that this study was from 1994 until 2011, and the study in terms of raising the minimum wage. Raising the minimum wage was supposedly a way in order to improve many of the problems that we had during the recession. And the result, unfortunately, from 2007 to 2011 was this huge increase in minority population of unemployment. So, facts and facts. And I remember the conversation regarding apples and oranges, but the fact is that they still stand.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to the next three testifiers because we have a full agenda. Thank you for your testimony, the three of you. The next three that we have up are Dan McElroy, David Burley, and Mike Jennings. So, Mr. McElroy, if you want to come on up, actually all three of you, and again, keeping your testimony to 2-3 minutes would be great, and we'll have opportunity for people to ask some questions.
We do have a substitution. Mr. Burley was not able to come back. Sean Topper is another member of ours, and he's here on Mr. Burley's behalf. We're here on behalf of his business and our members.
Very good. He's welcome
right.
as well.
Thank
of
you.
Course. And if you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Restaurant Association and the Minnesota Lodging Association. The discussion that we just heard reminds me of why then-President Harry Truman once said economists should only be allowed to speak when they have their hands in their pockets. So they cannot say on the one hand this and on the other hand exactly the opposite. I'm not an economist, and on behalf of my members, I'll try and keep this as general as I can. And then our members will provide more specifics about how the proposal before you will impact their business, their employees, and their communities. The restaurant industry has the most concern about this. The lodging industry also has some concerns for some of their occupation in some parts of the state. The restaurant industry will be a focus of this, and I also commend to your attention the report that King Banyan mentioned. Comes from the Minnesota Department of Labor, and it's the minimum wage report published in 2012 and based on 2011 data. Of the 93,000 Minnesotans who have, in that data set, worked at or below the minimum wage, about 42% of them worked in eating and drinking establishments, which is about 35% of our employees. The vast majority of those are eligible for tip income. And we have some income, some information about what they earn with the total of their wages and their tips. They also work flexible hours. Many are working while they are in college or graduate school or otherwise advancing in life. Others work so they can be home when their kids get on school buses and off school buses. And for some, it's their full-time career, and they are older workers. We don't have exact demographic data about the age of our employees, but we believe it's quite consistent with what the Department of Labor found. But about 60% of those working at minimum wage are 24 and younger, about 37% between 24 and 55, and about 3% 55 and older. The thing we're perhaps most proud of is the career path that many of people who work in restaurants enjoy. They may start as front counter workers at McDonald's and get great training in how to work and cleanliness, quality, service, and value, and proceed in that system or proceed through life. We're the first employer of somewhere between 50 and 60% of Minnesota's young people. My members are proud of the fact we teach young Minnesotans how to work outside the home and create jobs that are opportunities. But the industry is changing. According to figures provided by the National Restaurant Association, in 2007, about 50% of the volume done in restaurants across the country was done at table service restaurants. And that's where the opportunities are for people to make really good money. We just completed a survey of our members to find out what table service restaurant employees make in tips and wages, and found the average for those who responded, and it wasn't a universal response, but it was significant. I have about 100 locations that responded. It was about $18 an hour on a statewide basis and about $22 an hour in the metropolitan area. And that's possible in that portion of the business that's table service. Table service has declined from 50% of the business in 2007 to about 30% of the business today, and continues to change as concepts that are called fast casual. And just to kind of decode the industry, table service is pretty obvious. You sit down at a table, a server takes your order, brings you your food, takes care of your check. Fast casual, you order and pay at the counter. Quick service, you order and pay and get your food at the counter and then go to your table. The opportunities, although they're often significantly more than today's minimum wage, do not provide the high incomes that table service provide. And the proposal before us probably puts table service at greater risk. But rather than give you generalities, I'd like to turn the witness stand over to those who actually have to sign the front of paychecks in restaurants and can give you be more specific.
Good. Thank you very much.
John, and then with Mike Jennings.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, happily. Thank you very much. My name is Sean Taher. I work for a company called Taher Incorporated. I think, first of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. This is an incredible opportunity to be sit here and have the opportunity as a citizen and testify before the committee. So I was here this morning, and I had an opportunity to hear a lot of data and a lot of stories, and it actually inspired me to tell you guys a different side of the story. I want to tell you a story about a guy named Bruce Taher. Bruce Taher moved to the United States in 1964 after his father disowned him for wanting to move. He moved here with $50. So at the time, he took a minimum wage job, just as the discussion is that we're talking about here. Took the time to actually learn the language, picked up extra hours, and really just sort of committed himself to trying to ingrain himself in an opportunity, because this is a country that allows an opportunity that no other country, frankly, offers. Through his history there as a dishwasher, his roommate decided to quit his job. His roommate was the bartender. The bartender made more money than the dishwasher, so he goes up to his roommate and says, "Hey, you're for sure quitting." He says, "Yep, I'm done." He says, "Great. I'm going to go apply for your job." So he goes, applies for his jobs. Now he's the bartender making more money. Bruce's career has really been a story of just this. Opportunities that have opened the door in front of him, he decided to take advantage of. In 1981, Bruce started the organization with two people. Now, over the last 31 and a half years, we've hired on average one person every 2.5 business days. I think that's an incredible accomplishment on behalf of my father. The other year and a half of our history that we've been incorporated, we haven't been able to really hire jobs, and this is really why I chose to come here and testify today. The reason being is because we're really navigating through a lot of these discussions that you, as committee members, both at the state level and at the, and members of the national legislature, have to deal with. We're unclear as to where things are going, and unfortunately for us, it's required us to really be more focused on managing policy and not focused on innovation, creating jobs, trying to figure out what the new mousetrap is so that we can go sell and find new customers so that we can then go and create more jobs. I, on behalf of myself and the organization, really ask you guys to consider some of those things as you go into vote tomorrow and debate the rest of the week. We want to continue our responsibility here in the in the state of Minnesota and on what we do here nationally to grow jobs. And ask that this committee keep that in mind, is because we just that's all we really want to do.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Jennings, you identify us off the record, please, and go ahead.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mike Jennings, and my father and I own three restaurants, one Jimmy's Food and Cocktails, Scoreboard Bar and Grill, and JJ's Clubhouse, and they're all located in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. We employ a total of about 145 employees, of which about half are tipped minimum wage employees. Between my late grandfather, my father, who's 89 years old, and myself, our family has been in the restaurant business for 80 years, dating back to Prohibition. In fact, my grandfather was a bootlegger, and that's a whole different story in that. So. I'm here today to talk about the proposed increase in minimum wage and the impact that I see it'll happen on the bar and restaurant industry. To begin, the very first thing that my father taught me is that in order to be successful in the restaurant business, we absolutely need to have a balance. And the balance is between three parties. Number one, the employee. Number two, the customers. And number three, the owners. If we offer our employees a great place to work and an opportunity to make good money, and we offer our customers great food, great service, and a good value, then the operator is rewarded with a profit. It's just that simple. But sometimes it can be just that complicated. To be honest, I have to tell you that I don't see how increasing the wage for tipped employees, thus resulting in increase in menu prices, can be considered fair and balanced. I don't know how we can take these three parties and make it work with a minimum wage increase. And here's why. As most of you know, for starters, Minnesota is one of the only few states that does not allow tip credit, and thus we are now paying, typical person in this room and anywhere in Minnesota is paying more money for their meals than a typical state. Just to give you an idea how it works for my three restaurants, we have between 26,000 and 32,000 minimum wage hours per year per restaurant. 26,000 to 32,000 hours per restaurant. This results in an extra labor cost at each restaurant of approximately $120,000 per year. And I will provide any information and facts, and I'll open up my books to anyone that would like to take a look at them to verify what I'm saying today. And so $120,000 more in a year, how do I make that up? Well, it's pretty obvious. We've raised our menu prices. So what happens is when I compare to restaurants like in Wisconsin and other states, all of us in this room and in the state of Minnesota are paying more for their meals today than most anywhere in this country. That's a cold, hard fact, because restaurant operators just cannot absorb that cost. Just so you know, and I'm here just to give pure facts, and once again, I will back them up for anyone that would like to have it. If we get a raise to eventually to $10.50 an hour for tipped employees, each of my restaurants will take on an extra $90,000 to $100,000 a year in extra labor costs. On top of that, you know, that's not the only issue we have. We have the issues with trying to figure out how to make the health care reform work. food costs that are projected to be 6.5%. I know every one of you in your room have read that, and we know that is also a fact. And bills that are currently being heard in the Senate and the House that talk about raising our alcohol taxes. And the fact that we're still in a fragile economy, that's what's scary about it. So I've talked about all these things we're facing about, and I haven't even gotten to how in the world I'm going to take care of raises for hostesses, for cooks, and for managers, who are just as important to us. So in the end, there's a minimum wage increase for tipped employees. My options are going to be very limited, but they'll definitely include, number one, raising my prices on the menu, so that now you go eat a hamburger and a sandwich in Wisconsin, or you have a hamburger or sandwich in Minnesota, and it will cost you probably 50 cents to a dollar more than what it costs in Wisconsin and many other states.
About another minute.
Okay, I have about 30 seconds.
Okay.
All said, raising the minimum wage on tip servers and bartenders at the expense of customers, it's not fair, it's not balanced for all the parties involved. That's because we will end up losing customers as a result. Because in the end, there's just going to be a certain number of customers that just aren't going to be able to go out. The last thing is I think it's really important. The question is, how much do servers make in tipping? Thank you, Dan, for giving those statistics. But, you know, at this point, who knows who to believe. I'm asking each of you to do one thing and talk to somebody in your district, call up a restaurant operator and say, would you mind opening up your books for me? And I'd like to take a look at that. And that's where the facts will happen. Thank you for listening to me today.
Thank you much for your testimony. And we're just going to take a little break now to ask questions. So if you could just remain there. We have a few people on the list. We'll start with Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you all for your testimony. And I think it's really important to look at what you had just spoken to, which is not just this in a silo, not just minimum wage raise in a silo, but what you just alluded to, the fact that we're talking collectively in the legislature, we're talking about raising the alcohol tax. You have to deal with health care, the minimum wage. We also are talking about changing our sales tax structure, so now business to business will be taxed. We're talking about taxing or increasing the top 2% by 2%. And I know that we had a grocer here, Paul was here earlier, and he said that he is an S-Corp. And I'm not sure if either one of you are an S-Corp. When I finish my questions, you can say yes or no, or an S-Corp or an LLC or something to that effect that would be directly affected by the top wage income tax, which has been pointed out many times now that is not solely the rich. That is a business that is an S-Corp, an LLC, a partnership that has retained earnings, and it's the tax on the business itself. It's not the take-home for that owner. It's not their money that they take home. It's the retained earnings that stays in the company. So if you could speak to this piling up of effects upon your business. I know you just kind of had maybe 15 seconds or so that you were talking about it, but can one of the two of you restaurant owners speak to that, about this huge pile that is coming through the legislature on top of this minimum wage change? And then if you are, in fact, either an S-Corp, an LLC, or a partnership that would have that additional 2% tax.
Well,
Mr. Jennings?
Yes, thank you. I kind of painted a little bit of doom and gloom, but it's even more concerning than that. It's just there's so many moving parts going on right now, and I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do it because we're just barely coming out. There's too much stuff coming at to me at once. It's like we don't even know what it's going to cost us for health care. So if I throw on increased costs, increased minimum wage, health care, and all this, I just don't know how it's going to work.
I'd be happy to expand.
Mr. Taher?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So we are an S-Corp, so that is a very, very, very real issue at our house. I spoke to that a little bit in my testimony. We certainly have this sort of compiling effect going on. In all sincerity, I was talking to my dad in our SVP today. Our 12 most senior officials in the organization have spent the last 12 to 18 months worrying about USDA, FDA, B2B tax. Are we going to get charged for our third-party audit to do the accounting work? Do we going to pay taxes to our attorneys for all the employment law, for all of the corporate law? All of these things. These are very, very real issues at our house. And then you take on top of that the minimum wage component. And I think what we may not always talk or think about is the fact that if I take minimum wage to somewhere in the neighborhood of $10.55, the grill cook who's making $11 an hour now wants $14.55. The chef who's making $15 to $16 an hour now wants $20 an hour. It just keeps adding. And in all sincerity, we happily feed you guys here at the Capitol building. And as you all know, raising prices is the last thing on any of our list. But certainly not compensating the people that actually take care of my business is probably worse in my book. Our employees, the business doesn't take place in my office. The business takes place here in the ground, and it really requires those people to be compensated. So I appreciate what the committee is attempting to do, but I think we also have to keep in mind where does it come from? Because if we're going to do this tax, at some point my dad and I sit around the table and go, for what? So Representative O'Neill, it is a very compounding effect at our house and a very real discussion in our house.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I just wanted to say I appreciate all your entrepreneurship and, know that you operate Main Street businesses here in Minnesota, and I'd like to thank you first and foremost for providing jobs to other hardworking Minnesota families. And, with family business, I can fully connect. My family runs businesses together, and right now we are in a similar position looking at, some of this. And from my perspective, I'm happy to come patronize your business and others around the state and willing to pay that extra dollar for the food. For me, it's not about the bottom line. I live in a smaller community, and I know, we talk about money circles up there, spending money at each other's businesses. And I have no problem going in and knowing that the price is a little higher if I know it's going to support other hardworking people here. So I just wanted to make that comment, no question for you or anything. Yeah. But just know that you won't lose my business if you jack up your price a little bit and you're taking care of your employees. So.
We appreciate that.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill, I apologize. You had a follow-up?
Oh, well, please go ahead. Thank you. Thank you so much, Chair. I do have a follow-up because that's the one side of it. And I forgot to talk about the energy costs, because now we're talking about doing our renewable mandate up to 40% and then adding our 10% solar on top of that. So now we have energy costs that I'm sure restaurants consume quite a bit of energy with all of what you do there, right? So that's another compounding factor. And I'm sure tomorrow there'll be new ones, so we'll just leave it at that. But my question is, we had Paul come in, one of the grocers, and he spoke to the fact of his remedy. How would he try to stay in business if he possibly could in the competition that he is in, because he is a small grocer and he's up against Costco and Walmart and all of that. And I'm assuming that restaurant business is a little bit competitive. Yes, okay. So my question to you is, what is the remedy? How would you manage this huge compounding factor of all of these additional things with more coming at us like a freight train every single day? He had mentioned things like raising prices, which you alluded to, but can you speak to a few other remedies of what you would have to do to make your business survive through this?
Mr. McElroy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, both the National Restaurant Association and our organization have asked members that. I don't have enough of a sample that we can release a scientific survey, but I do know of the people who have responded, 90% said that they would raise prices. About 65% said they would reduce hours for their current employees. About 65% said that they would hire fewer people in the future. About 50% said that they would delay or cancel capital investments, which is a really big deal because the investments I hear about lately are more energy efficient equipment and equipment that delivers better food faster. And so delaying those investments is not a good thing. A smaller number would cancel what are called meal parts. They may close for breakfast or lunch that they are now open. That also impacts jobs. A smaller number would reconcept and have their guests order at the counter rather than at the table. A few talked about closing locations. A few talked about moving to neighboring states. Restaurants are growing faster in metropolitan areas like Moorhead and Hudson than they are in their counterpart Minnesota locations because of the difference of cost. But that's what we know so far.
I would also like to add, I really didn't want to bring this up as my other option, although I did have it written down here, is that technology, and that's going to be one of my keys. I went over to Europe, saw that everyone uses a handheld. Have you ever seen that? And the primary driving force behind that is saving on costs, on labor costs. I did quote it already. It was going to cost me about $40,000 to $50,000. And I'm like, wow, my payback period. And the whole idea, by the way, is they start doing stuff quicker. They don't, rather than taking down an order and then going and repeating it into the computer, you're already entering it into the computer. So rather than having, say, 10 servers on the floor, maybe I can go up to 8 servers or 7 servers and become offer at least as good a service. Now, when I'm looking at, you know, costs approaching $90,000 and $100,000 a year, a $40,000 or $50,000 investment with less than a 6-month return would be it'd be a slam dunk. And so what was well out of reach is now going to become part of it. And I think that is similar to what Dan had to say, is that now the increase in quick casual, where we're eliminating workforce because we can't afford it.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I add just a...
Just briefly, because yeah, we have absolutely. A couple people with questions here.
For us, it's unfortunately not a very simple answer. That we'll do a combination of all of that stuff in all sincerity. I think really for us what it does is it ties up so much of the key leadership, so much of the key resources in our organization that allow us to go out and sell, go out and allow us to grow and allow us to, you know, create more jobs. It's more that for us than it is, you know, what do we do? Do we find about closing a restaurant? Do we reduce the hours? I mean, the truth is we'll do some crazy algorithm of them all, right? But for us, it ties up the key resources to really go out and grow our business and then in turn grow more jobs.
Very good. Thank you. And people in the audience, you might notice people coming and going a little bit. There are other committees going on, and so don't take it personally. There are people that have to come and go. So with that, I know there's a couple of people that have tax committee. I want to make sure they can say for a few words if they so desire. Representative Savick?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have a story to tell. My mother owned a restaurant when I was younger. My dad was disabled, and she bought a restaurant to support the family. And every time that there was a minimum wage increase, she'd start crying because when she started, they weren't making a lot of money. Eventually, she made it a very high-paying restaurant. And she'd start crying about the minimum wage. The truth was, I was the bookkeeper, and every time there was a minimum wage increase, her business increased, and she became more profitable. And that's just an anecdote that I have, and that's what happened with, it was a small town cafe. More people had more money to spend, and they spent it at the restaurant.
Good. Thank you. Representative Dinovich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say that I appreciate all three of you testifiers coming in. At the previous committee earlier, I disclosed that I am in support of raising the minimum wage. I don't think I'm sponsored on the bill that's at 1055, but I am on one of the minimum wage bills. I don't run a business. I can certainly appreciate the difficulty that goes behind it. I understand that you've probably got a great deal of drive. And to that, I appreciate Representative O'Neill's comments earlier about this not existing in a silo, that there are other effects. And I'd just like to speak to perhaps some of those other effects. When I think about the minimum wage, I don't think about it necessarily from the side of someone who's employing people, but rather who has friends who work for the minimum wage or just above that. And so I just want to mention my best friend, Tyler, and he's someone who had two children pretty young. He works three jobs right now. His wife is an LPN. He makes barely the minimum wage at any of his jobs, and he doesn't know if he can stop working to improve his education, to get better trained and value added. So he's got that dilemma, and he's also sort of facing a freight train, if you will, because his wages are stagnant or relatively stagnant compared to inflation, and so he has to wonder about things like health care as well. He has to worry about energy costs. He has to worry about child care and things of that nature. And so this question is actually directed towards Mr. Jennings. I know that you totaled up what it might cost you per restaurant to increase the minimum wage. I don't know, had you figured out per worker what they might be taking home in additional money?
Mr. Jennings?
I haven't put a calculator to that, but if I, in one location I have about 25 employees, $90,000 to $100,000 would be in that $35,000 or $4,000 per employee range.
Okay, and I appreciate that. And I think that, you know, one of the things that goes to be said here is that this money doesn't just suck out in a vacuum, that it is put back into paychecks. And I think that one of the ideas behind, you know, I think the economist is Joseph Stiglitz right now who's peddling this idea that when that money goes back into consumers, you know, they then might be able to afford, for instance, to eat at your restaurant more often. And so I think that, you know, there is another side of the story to be told, and I appreciate, again, you guys coming out, and certainly I look forward to hearing more from you.
Can I respond at all? Do you mind, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, okay. Briefly.
I really do appreciate your comments because, I mean, these are the people that we employ. Like, these are real people, and I do support. I actually do fully subscribe to the logic that says if I give you more money, then you'll spend more money or save it or go to school or something to the effect. I think the struggle that we face is that there are too many people that don't have a job, and we want to get those people a job. Then we can talk about getting everyone else, because in my opinion, if I can get half the people that don't have a job now a job, those people now I'm increasing the potential number of people that can actually come into my restaurant or eat at the cafe. And then I think that's an extremely appropriate time to have this exact same discussion, because you have great logic in it.
Very good. The last question for this group, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Chair, and for both of the gentlemen that own the restaurants. It's been my experience that very few restaurants offer health care to their people, and I know at least one of you had mentioned that. So I'd be curious as to what percentage of your employees do you actually cover with health care?
Mr. Jennings?
Well, I think part of the reason why it's my management staff. And I do not provide it for the others, as do probably most restaurants out there. And it really gets down to one thing. It's because, and for the same reason why our managers in this industry work 50 to 55 hours a week, it's because we can't afford it. It's cost prohibitive. But that will be a solution here come January 1st, though.
Thank you very much.
For my organization.
Mr. Taher?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have enough good data to answer the question for the committee. I apologize.
Okay. Thank you. As I said, it's
Representative Mason, do you have a follow-up?
Well, I know one young man that worked. He finally got out of the restaurant industry when he was about 31 years old and had a job. That's the first time he ever had benefits. He served server, bartender for many, many years and liked the place he worked, but no benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. We're going to move on to the next three. Thank you very much. Mr. Lundberg, Bree Halverson, Joshua Winters, if you three want to come on up and have a seat. Bree, you want to identify yourself for the record and go ahead and get started.
Great. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good evening, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brianna Halverson, and I'm the State Director for Working America, which is a community affiliate of the AFL-CIO for people who do not have the benefit of a union on the job. We have 260,000 members here in Minnesota, and I'm here to express support on their behalf for House File 92, which is raising the minimum wage to $10.55. Every night we're on the doors talking to people about economic issues that they care about. What is clear is that Minnesota needs good paying jobs. People are struggling to piece together two or three jobs at $7.25 an hour, and they still aren't making ends meet. There is more than enough evidence that a higher minimum wage will benefit working families and our Minnesota communities. A lot of times, you know, we miss the important conversation about values, and I'd like to read a story that we got from one of our members at the door. And her letter is, "My name is Eva. I am an admissions coordinator at the local treatment center for a drug and alcohol addiction Center. I see people every day that need help to recover from the disease of addiction, and they make huge try to make huge changes in their lives to do so. However, when they begin looking for employment after treatment, they are only able to offer secure employment at minimum wage jobs that pay $7.25 an hour, and they can only schedule them sometimes 20 to 30 hours a week. That pay isn't enough for them for the cost of living and the rent at the local sober house in St. Paul. Because of the lack of funds, I see addicts have to leave the support and community of the sober house and return home to the tense family environments that are filled with dynamics that are difficult to stay sober in. By increasing minimum wage, you would be helping people support themselves without government assistance and giving them a chance to rebuild their lives and become useful, productive members of the community. And $10.55 an hour would start that process. Please consider increasing the minimum wage. So Minnesota can do better, and that's what we're asking to do. We're here to ask to raise the minimum wage so that all Minnesotans can start to be productive in the community. We have a number of members who are small business owners. These business owners have chosen to pay their employees more than the minimum wage. They tell us that paying their employees a good wage makes for a more productive workforce, reduces turnover, and makes for a stronger community. And they're hoping that places like Walmart and McDonald's will start to follow suit. And raising the minimum wage would help do just that. We are asking for a minimum wage that is meaningful and significant and have a positive impact on thousands of Minnesotans. By increasing the minimum wage, we'll actually have an opportunity to affect the lives of about 500,000 Minnesotans. Let us delay no longer. The message I want to leave with you today is that we cannot wait. This legislation is long overdue, and that is what our members tell us every night. On behalf of our members, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on raising the minimum wage.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman, for your testimony. Mr. Lundberg, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Wade Luneberg. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of Unite Here, Local 17, and the Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions. We represent 6,000 members in hotels, restaurants, clubs, sports venues, convention centers, MSP airport, cafeterias, and also a little bit of manufacturing. We still do a little bit of that here in Minnesota. Today I'd like to speak specifically about our industry and the minimum wage. Unite Here, through a long and lively history of collective bargaining, has set the standard for the much larger industry. We believe that working people and their families lead better lives through collective bargaining. We know that properties that have collected for the much larger industry. We believe that working people and their families lead better lives through collective bargaining. We know that properties that have collective bargaining agreements simply pay more, have good insurance that is easily affordable and great benefits, and also a pension benefit. We call it the union difference. I also recognize that not everyone will be in the union. The higher standard is achieved with willing employers and employees who value the work that each of them do. Last month, U.S. News and World Report named the 20 top hotels in Minnesota, with the top three being union properties and five in the top 10 being union properties. Hospitality is a vibrant and important part of Minnesota's economy. That said, there's much left to do, and according to the trade group Hospitality Minnesota itself, describes it as a $10 billion industry with 261,000 workers, involving 1 in 10 Minnesotans, and with a projected 14% growth rate from 2004 to 2014. As this important discussion progresses, there'll be various proposals brought forward with almost no one questioning the need for an increase of some kind, but how much and what kind is the question. About 40% of all minimum wage workers reside in our industry. Those 40,000 folks are more often exclusively servers being paid $7.25 an hour plus their tips. Servers often share their tips, which are not wages, with other workers in the restaurant and hotels, providing a real cushion for the balance of that workforce. In the past, there have been many attempts to actually pay servers less. With a 250,000 Minnesota workers in hospitality, we have a great opportunity to create real change that is meaningful for workers and for Minnesota's economy. Our organized properties, using hotels as an example, and housekeepers as the majority of the workforce in any hotel, offers $11.50 an hour start rates with employer and union negotiated health care and a pension benefit. In the much larger part of the hotel industry, housekeepers have start rates in the metro area of around $8.50 an hour and are likely offered less access to benefits. By raising the minimum wage to even just $9.50 in three steps, there is no doubt you would capture the vast majority of workers in the industry and would give them the real ability to more easily pay a utility bill, a car payment, or rent. While not probably enough to allow for starting a savings plan, we can count on the increase in workers' wages to go directly back into the economy, and quickly. Legislation should also include indexing that restores the parity to the industry wage standards between classifications and puts workers and their families on a more reliable pay income equality. I want to be clear and say that I'm not being critical of employers in the industry or their motives, but for too long, wages have stagnated in an industry that consistently has grown and is usually the first to recover in the economy. My industry already relies on a large percentage of minimum wage workers that deliver good, reliable service along with a skilled workforce at the back of the house. Today, we are more and more part of a service-oriented economy. Now is the time to embrace this and not think of these as temporary and transitional jobs, but an opportunity for long-term careers that benefit businesses, workers, and the consumer.
And just to wind it up then, Mr. Lemon.
And thank you very much.
Well done. Questions, members, for these two testifiers? Seeing none, we'll move on. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to go with four here, and that's they're here. Rochelle Westland, Paul Ostergaard, Ken Rockler, and Paul Svensson. Any of that group, please come on down. No. Please have a seat at the table. And you may go ahead, ma'am, and identify yourself and
thank you, Mr.
Again,
Chair.
Keep it to 3 minutes or so. That'd be great.
My name is Rochelle Westland, and I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association.
Welcome.
Thank you. Paul Ostergaard was supposed to join me, but he was unable to attend this evening, so he will no longer be here. The retailers industry employs about 480,000 people in the state of Minnesota and makes up about 14% of Minnesota's GDP. So it's a very large part of the Minnesota economy. The Minnesota Retailers Association represents about 1,500 storefronts statewide in the Twin Cities and in rural Minnesota. The minimum wage issue is a very big issue for retailers as they're looking to do the cost of their business. We employ people at starting wages and in minimum wages, and retailers who manage stores, and in, as Jeff Lindu, who is a member of our board, spoke this morning, has positions in the retail industry that do pay high wages as well, pharmacists that are employed in their pharmacies. An increase in the minimum wage is going to affect our business as far as bringing in new employees to be able to work in starting wage jobs. We employ a lot of people during their college years and their high school years as their introduction into the Minnesota workforce, and we are happy to be a part of that system. A lot of the numbers and statistics that I have, you've already heard tonight, and so we would just really like to reiterate that, you know, increasing a minimum wage by this magnitude and then indexing it every year, which is an even greater concern of ours just as the accounting goes back and forth, is of great concern to retailers in the state.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. And next up?
Mr. Chairman.
Pull yourself to that one of those microphones there and then identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Svensson. I live at 508 Valley Circle, Wayzata, Minnesota. I'm a partner in two independent restaurants here in the metropolitan area. Our tipped employees work nearly 75,000 hours annually. So when the minimum wage was increased by $2.10 from 207 to 209, our cumulative labor cost increase were over $325,000. If minimum wage is increased during the years 2013 through 2015 without a tip credit provision, as proposed by Senate File 504, the cumulative impact on our two restaurants would be almost $540,000. Furthermore, the total cumulative impact of the past and the proposed minimum wage increases from 207 to 2015 without tip credit would be over $1,750,000. These costs we can't absorb, obviously, so they need to be passed on to our customers, to the consumers. This means that the failure to allow tip credit collectively costs Minnesotans many millions of dollars every year. Also, labor cost increases will diminish both jobs and hours worked in many full-service restaurants. As full-service restaurants' prices increase, customers will seek less expensive alternatives, such as counter service establishments like Cipelli, Quilty, and Pantera Bread, which doesn't allow tipping, and they employ a lot fewer employees for the number of customers served. Additionally, higher prices will cause some people to eat at home a bit more often, so this factor will also decrease customer counts and will result in less jobs and fewer hours worked. Those that regularly oppose tip credit often try to base their opposition on what they claim are the dire economic factors related to the earnings of tipped employees. But the reality is that tipped employees often make two and sometimes even three times the hourly wage of non-tipped employees. Further minimum wage increases without tip credit will dramatically increase labor costs, and this would make it highly unlikely that full-service restaurants would be able to consider giving raises to the non-tipped employees, very prudent decision, as it would require them to raise their prices even further. So the bottom line is the failure to pass tip credit legislation will increase the hourly wages of the highest paid hospitality workers at the expense of lowest paid hospitality workers. There are 42 other states represented by over 6,500 legislators that have found the reasons to support tip credit persuasive. I hope Minnesota will join these other states and support tip credit again as they did once in the past. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Rockler, could identify yourself for the record, please?
Sure. Chairman Winkler, Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, Ken Rockler representing the Tavern League of Minnesota and the bowling proprietors. I'll probably go a little bit against some of my friends that have been testifying here in that my major issue is not the minimum wage. I don't think it would behoove us to go up too fast, too dramatically, but I'm here on the tip credit. There's no question about it. You were passed out a chart. I don't know if everybody brought it tonight, but on the front page it talks about the exact comparison between Minnesota, and I just happen to choose the entire Big Ten and the Dakotas, but as has been mentioned before, either 42 or 43 states have a tip credit. I think the salient figure here is that Illinois, which is the highest salaried state with the exception of Minnesota, we are 46.45% higher on our tipped employees. What is tip credit, by the way? I've gone around to the Capitol now. I've probably spoken with just about 100 legislators over the past 6 weeks. And I know you have a lot of different issues that you have to learn. I will say this. I think less than 1 out of 10 people really understand where the tip credit comes from and what it's all about. Tip credit is the realization that while only the servers get a direct tip from the customers, that it's actually a team effort, the old there's no I in team. With that realization, the federal government in 43 states allow an employer to make up the difference between the minimum wage with the amount of tips that are earned at that point by the server. Somebody said that tips weren't a wage. I just heard that before. Actually, tips are a wage. Minnesota considers them a wage in every way possible. They charge Social Security, FICA, payroll. It's only not considered a wage when it comes to the minimum, the Wage Act at this point. The next page I'd like you to look at, if you've got the packet, is there's three pages in there that have the IRS Tip Reporting Determination Act in there. The debate is over as to whether or not who the highest paid employees are in a restaurant. Who won that debate? The IRS. 25 years ago, they put in standards that are in there in those three pages. And what they said was, we know that there's a lot of money being made in tips. Therefore, every restaurant is going to have to do the following. They have to report their gross sales, their charge sales, the gross tips declared, and the charge tips declared. And if for some reason a restaurant has less than 8% of their gross sales declared as tips, then it's up to the owners to allocate those tips, and the minutiae is in that three-page system right there. But what does that mean? How does that relate to wages? Well, if in fact a server says, well, I don't make 8% of my gross sales, he or she is allowed actually to say, well, I'd like to have an IRS audit. To the best of my knowledge, in 25 years, 50 states and the District of Columbia, no server has ever asked for an audit. Somebody might be aware of it. And by the way, we want our servers not to make $10 an hour, $20 an hour. We want them to make $50 an hour. If you're coming there as customers, are they going to be happier and serve you better if they're making $50 an hour or if they're making $10 an hour? But the net result on this is that by having the tip credit that we are doing right now, and I heard that Mr. McElroy testify earlier, we are driving people from full service places where they make the most amount of money into fast casual and casual. I just went for the first time to a Panera Bread. It was mentioned by Mr. Svensson here. I didn't realize it. I tried to leave a tip. You are not allowed to leave a tip there. Now, it costs you a lot less to go there, and they're very successful. They're the darlings of Wall Street right now. But when you raise these wages without giving a tip credit, you are driving people away from the highest paid jobs to jobs that are one-third or one-half of that amount. Representative O'Neill asked, what type of solution would we in the restaurant business have? Well, mine's going to be a little bit more dramatic than anybody else has talked about here, but I really truly believe that if my son or daughter were right now in the restaurant business working as a server, a bartender, or a waitress, I believe they would make more money with this proposition. And that's, let's do this. Let's have the tipped wage, or the cash wage as it's known, in Minnesota. Let's go to $4.50. Some people say you want to decrease the wages. Well, I don't think it does decrease the earnings in most of the cases. Because most of the time, tipped employees, where they make their money, is by the most amount of business that comes through. But let's have a Minnesota exception in there. Let's use an idea that was actually proposed by two legislators from Woodbury a number of years ago and was supported by a bipartisan group, both Democrats and Republicans. Let's not allow that tipped wage in Minnesota unless the tip server every single pay period makes at least $11 an hour. I don't know if anybody has an objection to that system, but I haven't been able to figure out a logical reason why, and I know that the people in the back of the house would benefit from that, and they are truly the ones that we need to boost up.
And take about a minute more, and we want to make sure questions.
Well, I know that it's a tricky subject. It's hard to do, but I know you have a lot of things going on. I would both stand for questions, and I live right by here. I'm available from dawn to dusk if anybody needs a further description on the tip credit. But thanks for the time and the opportunity to speak before you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have quite a few questions. But Mr. Rackler, thanks. I think that really puts it in light. And something you said towards the end is, you know, if you lower that cost of doing business, those prices on the meals don't have to go up. You're going to get more customers, not less, eating out. Because part of what we saw in the recession was the first thing you can cut out is eating out, right? It's a way to save money. So as we start to grow out of this recession and we want to encourage people to go out to the restaurants, I think that's a really good point to think about. I don't know where Rep. Winkler is the author of the bill. He might be in another committee.
Civil law.
Okay, civil law. I'm sorry, but I'll make sure I talk to him about this because I think a lot of what we have talked about today is surrounding the service industry and this tip issue, and I think that's really critical in this discussion. And I also just want to say, Mr. Swenson, thank you. You have a great restaurant in Woodbury, Sunset. But my question will go to Rochelle Westland.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, with the retailers, how are you hearing from your members? You know, if we tax clothing and now we're going to increase the wages that I know a lot of your employees are the teenagers in the high school because, you know, that's where I bring my kids to shop. So I just wondered, what is the feedback you're getting? What are they predicting are going to be possible layoffs, if any? Thank you.
Ms. Westland, you want to comment?
I haven't been able to speak to any of our retailers about what their possible layoffs are. I know with the vast tax changes that are happening and are being discussed upstairs currently, there is a lot of concern with how they're going to manage once there's increased taxes on items that haven't been taxed before, and not only how that affects their bottom line and ability to hire, but also what it does to their consumer as far as consumers' ability to spend, what they have for disposable income after, you know, the sales tax on clothes is expanded, and what that does to their business and their bottom line as well.
Very good. Representative Radinovich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Ms. Westland. And could you tell me just what the number of people working in retail is again? I didn't catch that.
Ms. Westland?
480,000,
okay. I actually had the opportunity to work in retail at one point in time. It may surprise some of my fellow committee members, but I thought I had a unique talent for selling women's shoes. I got to work on commission, which was great because I hustled. I worked hard. Do you know how many of your retail employees across the state of Minnesota work on a commission basis in addition to the base wage?
Ms. Westland? Thank you, Mr. Chair. That I do not know. I could look into that and get more information back to you.
Okay, that'd be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And and the only reason I ask again is, I think that one of the ideas behind this minimum wage discussion is that productivity has increased so dramatically over the last, 50 years in America. And if you were to have pegged the minimum wage to productivity, we'd be talking about, a number much, much higher than $10 an hour right now, or $9.25 or $7.50, or, it's all over. We've got a bunch of different proposals. But if you could get those numbers on commission, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your – oh, you had a question, Mr. President O'Neill?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I told them I didn't have a question, but I actually do. This is actually for the retailers also. And have you been hearing from your members at all that with, not just the minimum wage talk, but you had talked about, there are many, many things happening in this building all at the same time. And, there's, for the tavern people, there's the liquor tax increase. There's tax on clothing, changing our entire sales tax structure to taxing the top 2%, which really for the good portion of those are actually S corps, retained earnings, and LLCs and partnerships, which I'm sure many of the retailers, if they're independently owned, are S corps or LLCs. Is there any talk of them maybe leaving the state? Is there talk of them closing their doors because they just can't sustain all of these changes happening at the same time with, $3.7 billion of increased revenue, taxes coming basically between sales taxes and that top tier tax, which would essentially hit the business, the retail businesses that are S corps or LLCs? Have your members talked at all about remedies like leaving the state or closing their doors?
Ms. Westland?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I haven't heard much about leaving the state. There is a lot of concern among the border communities on whether or not they will be able to keep their doors open with competition across state borders and state lines. So I know there is concern about that. No one that I've talked to wants to close their business, so it's about what can they do to survive. But they're still waiting to see where everything comes down.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to move on to the next. Alexandra Fitzsimmons, Chris Jacobs, Bernie Hess. If you three are here, please come on down and we'll get started. And we're more or less concluding those we have on our list. And if there's others who are in the audience who want to testify, you'll certainly get that opportunity as well. And we'll go with ladies first. If you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. We develop and advocate for policies that do two things. First, that improve the well-being of children, and second, strengthen the economic security of families. And we believe that raising the minimum wage does both of these. The economic security of a family is critical to the health and well-being of its children and the future prosperity of our state. Children from families with sufficient financial resources are far more likely than children from economically disadvantaged families to start kindergarten ready to succeed and to flourish in school and later in life. Families with greater financial resources can better meet basic needs and provide enriching opportunities for their children. Findings from a 2011 Brookings Institution study examining the effects of family income on school readiness suggest that an additional $1,000 of average family income throughout early childhood can result in higher reading and math scores for children in lower income families. As the wages of low and middle income working Minnesotans continue to stagnate, the cost of housing, utilities, food, childcare, transportation, and health care continue to increase. It costs a family of three, one adult, and two children approximately $46,000 a year to meet basic needs. Yet, a parent working full-time earning the federal minimum wage has a gross income of approximately $15,000, leaving a family of three at only 77% of the federal poverty level. I want to focus briefly on the cost of housing and childcare in Minnesota. In Washington County, for example, fair market rent for a modest two-bedroom apartment is $904 a month. 48% of renters are unable to afford the rent. In terms of minimum wage, a worker would need to work 96 hours per week in order to afford the rent. In St. Louis County, turning to child care now, licensed family-based child care for an infant is $6,800 per year and $6,400 per year for a toddler. Low income and resulting material hardship affects parenting and child outcomes. It increases family stress, including the types of toxic stress that affect brain growth and development during a child's earliest years. Material hardships such as food insecurity or substandard housing can constrain the time and money parents can invest in their children, can lead to parental stress, depression, and poor health, and can result in inattentive or even harsh parenting, which directly affect children's social and emotional development. Increases in income can improve a family's emotional well-being and can be used for child-centered goods like books, early childhood opportunities, or even to move to a better neighborhood. Before closing, I want to leave you with a few numbers. First, I know you heard from the EPI on Monday. When the EPI analyzed the impact of the Harkin-Miller proposal to increase the federal minimum wage to $9.80 an hour, they found that 284,000 Minnesota children would be impacted by that raise. That's 22% of Minnesota's children. Second, according to the USDA's cost of raising a child calculator, it costs a family of four, two parents, two children ages 2 and 6 living in the Midwest with income less than $59,000, $17,000 a year to raise two children. Third, a child from a low-income family who enters first grade has been exposed on average to just 25 hours of one-on-one picture book reading, whereas an entering middle-income child has been exposed to an average of more than 1,000 hours of such reading, so a comparison between 25 hours and 1,000 hours. Lastly, when the Urban Institute simulated a grouping of policies for the Legislative Commission to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020, that simulation included a $9.50 minimum wage increase. It also included four other policies: fully funding and expanding eligibility for our basic sliding fee child care program, expanding the working family credit. They assumed an increased food support participation rate of 85%, and then also expanding education and training for adults under 50. The findings by the Urban Institute were remarkable. Poverty in Minnesota was reduced by 27%. 35,000 workers had a new job. There were nearly $11 billion in increased wages and $2.6 billion in government savings. We believe it is important to consider the minimum wage from the perspective of child well-being, and especially the well-being of our youngest children. We believe in the value of all children as children, but we must also consider how our policies will impact the lives of our children as future parents, teachers, firefighters, lawyers, nurses, and yes, legislators. We must place this policy within the continuum of school readiness, school success, and adult achievement. Family income affects investments in children. Increasing family income by increasing the minimum wage will help children. And by improving child development outcomes, we will also help to ensure our state's future prosperity. So thank you for your time and your dedication, and we are excited to be part of this important discussion.
Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Jacobs, identify yourself for the record, please. And
Mr. Chair, I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Jobs Now Coalition. We represent 100 organizations statewide who ignore their differences to focus on what they have in common, and that is their belief that people who work ought to be able to achieve a decent standard of living. I just want to point out that we just passed out a copy of some information, speaking of data points and statistics, Mr. Chair, that show what kitchen workers make in states surrounding Minnesota that all have a tip penalty. The kitchen workers in those states do not make more than the kitchen workers in Minnesota. We just wanted to point out those facts for you. But I'm going to begin today with a shorter testimony that I had planned for, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have my full remarks passed out, if you don't mind, after I'm through here.
Very good. We love shorter comments.
Let me begin by summarizing what we know about Minnesota's low-wage labor market. The average cost of meeting basic needs for a family of four with two workers working with two kids in Minnesota is $58,000, as my colleague just pointed out. To cover these costs, each worker must earn $14.03 an hour. According to Deeds labor market research outfit, almost 40% of jobs in Minnesota, more than a million jobs, pay less than a family supporting wage of $14.03 an hour. At the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, a couple with two children would have to work 155 hours a week to meet their basic needs. If the purchasing power of the minimum wage had kept pace with inflation since the late 1960s, it would now be $10.59 an hour as of today. One of every five jobs in Minnesota, more than a half a million jobs, pay less than the inflation-adjusted minimum wage, and in greater Minnesota, one in every four jobs pays less. So, lest you think that this is a marginal group, there's not very many of them, it's not very important to act as if we don't have a large, low-wage labor market in Minnesota is a mistake. 30% fall below $12 an hour, and that is our point where a single person with no dependent needs to make a living. We've also heard about the harm to small businesses. According to the U.S. Business Administration, 362,700 of Minnesota's small businesses, or 76%, are owner-operated with no employees. No employees. So for these businesses, minimum wage is a non-issue. It really stymies me why we talk about there aren't very many people and they don't really need the money, and yet it's such a big problem for business to see the wages go up. In our view, when you've got that as many employees as these gentlemen were talking about earlier, and you've been getting what is basically a government-subsidized $3 an hour minimum wage relief by government keeping the cost of the minimum wage artificially low, what we see now is labor market failure for the vast majority of Minnesota workers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Jacobs. And Mr. Hess, if you want to identify yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1189. We represent workers in three sectors: retail, grocery, long-term care, and food processing. And retail workers in this state, it's the fastest growing sector of jobs. And we think we support efforts to raise the minimum wage. It's good to get that money right back into the economy. And these folks that we would put the money into their hands are going to put it back in right away. I just want to throw out a couple of things for you to think about this as you're going through it. We want to lift workers up. And by doing that in retail, we're talking about a number of the retailers that we think are getting a free ride right now. And I'll just throw out a couple things to you. In big box retailers, Target, Walmart, we've done a number of studies about the cost to communities, the cost to state. And on average, it's about $400,000 per unit, per big box, that costs state and feds with the hidden subsidies, as we call it. The hidden subsidies are things that you may not always think about, but because workers aren't making a living wage or a better wage, often their kids qualify for reduced school lunches. A number of folks qualify for Section 8 rental assistance. There's federal tax credits for low-income families. There's other contributions such as the Children's Health Insurance Program. Also, a few years ago, I asked some of the legislators to get us some information for who uses MA the most among some of the employers in the state. And the top four on the list were Target, Walmart, McDonald's, and Labor Ready, a day labor thing. What I would ask you to do is, one, we support it. We'd ask that you support raising the minimum wage. And also look, if you're looking for additional information, I would suggest that you go to the website, Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Stacy Mitchell's done some really good research around big box and the effects on local economies. And also Good Jobs First puts out something about the hidden subsidies. And just to show you the numbers we've calculated with the hidden subsidies to big box retailers in this state, it's about $48 million. And that's considering that Walmart has 64 stores in the state, and I think Target's at about 53 stores right now. So when you go in for the low, low price, okay, but you're also, through your tax dollars, and we're all taxpayers, are subsidizing those costs. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. We have Representative O'Neill, question?
Thank you, Chair. I think you said that you, part of the group that you are here to represent was long-term care. Yes, okay, great, because we have in our packet, there's a handout that they could not be here apparently, and so they submitted something from long-term care, which I think is really important for us to consider all the aspects, and since we have someone here that the union here is represented here, I'd like to read just a portion of this. And in their letter here to Representative Winkler and Senator Sparks, it says in part, regardless of these details, we remain concerned that any minimum wage increase will have negative impacts on long-term care providers. It goes on to say, any proposal to increase the minimum wage will uniquely impact senior care providers because they rely significantly on Medicaid rates, which are controlled by the state. Here we are. And then it talks about the current rate. And it says, this underfunding is putting 85 nursing homes at the state at an operation margin of minus 5% or greater and at risk of closure. So they're concerned about closure. And then they go on to have some specific impacts back here when we start to phase in this proposal. So beginning on August 1st, 2015, the annual cost of compliance for nursing facilities is estimated to be $32.5 million. Now, I just have a question for the author, if that's all right, just in relation to this as I'm reading this.
Probably yield to go ahead with your question.
I appreciate your latitude with me. Do we have a fiscal note? Because obviously this minimum wage impact will directly impact, because it says we are controlling their, it's right there in their letter, it says we control the Medicaid rate. So is there a fiscal note to look at the impacts of minimum wage across all of the aspects that the state would have to now increase some these, well, just for one example, Medicaid rate, so that they can be in compliance, because they, now they're saying here that by 2015 they'd be $32.5 million short to be in compliance with the new law. And they go on from there and list a few more things, but that would be my question is, do we have a fiscal note with this?
President Winkler, do you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to, and Representative O'Neill. I think it's curious to sort of think about what you're saying. The kind of implicit argument is that because we pay providers who take care of senior citizens so little, we cannot afford to pay the people who take care of senior citizens any more than $7 or $8 an hour. So because we are unwilling to spend the money to actually take care of people in their senior years when they're unable to support themselves, we have to hold down those wages. So no, we don't have a fiscal note. I certainly support legislation, and perhaps you'll join us in raising the rates for nursing homes, because they certainly are long due. And you know, it's interesting, you sort of talk about, you raise this issue about public assistance and the impact on the state budget. And I'm not saying this to cast blame on anybody, but if you look at the industries where they have workers who are working and getting public assistance like food stamps or child care assistance, the predominant industries are in temp agencies, retail, food service, and healthcare/social service. So it's just those very people. It's PCAs and nursing home workers, people in retail, it's people in food service, it's the temp agencies we heard from earlier. Now, I'm not saying that those industries are doing something wrong, but the fact is that, a lot of workers in Minnesota are getting help from taxpayers because they can't earn enough in their jobs in order to make ends meet. And so, you know, I understand that the minimum wage is not the be-all, end-all answer to the challenge of living wages, but it seems to me we're in a bit of a deflationary cycle when we need to pay people less so that they can afford to pay for cheaper food and cheaper services and cheaper goods and cheaper locations with less service. The idea of building a kind of bottom-up economy would be to pay workers more so that they have more money to spend and increase total demand in the economy, which helps drive taxpayer dollars, or it helps drive tax revenue, it helps drive business revenue, and when actually more people are making more money and able to spend it in their lives, we're going to see a much bigger economic boost from that. We'll have more money to pay for nursing homes. But if we continue down the other path and only look at cutting costs and cutting workers and holding that back, we're not ever going to work our way out of a very slow economy, in my opinion. And this is way more editorial than I started, but you kind of asked the question, and so I guess it's fair for me to respond. The fact is that it is going to cost us more to pay workers more, but I have yet to understand the logic of how we're going to be a more prosperous state by making less money. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Professor Neal, you have the floor. Do you have any more questions for our testifiers, or can we let them go?
I do not.
You guys are free to keep moving, but go ahead. You have the floor.
I appreciate that, Chair. Thank you so much. You know, I think that as responsible committee members, I appreciate Representative Winkler what you're saying, and I think that that's an incredibly valuable discussion. But what our job here is to look at all of the consequences, all of the fallout, so to speak. And I think it's important for us to look at this, like I said earlier, not just in a silo. And if we are talking about an already $1.4 billion deficit that the state of Minnesota has going into this budget cycle, I think it's important to look at all of the unintended consequences, or maybe intended consequences. Apparently this was an intended consequence, I guess it is what you were trying to say, that you would like to see all of these wages increase, which would be, it's a very honorable thing. But I think that we need to look at what does that cost and how are we going to get there, because we're already talking about raising $3.7 billion in additional revenue. And that's coming from the private sector, because government doesn't produce anything. So that's coming from the private sector. And I, you know, it's not just long-term care people. I talked to a disability group home in my neighborhood, in my community on Friday, talked to the regional director of REM. I'm sure you've heard of REM, right? So that's a pretty big organization. And they were extremely concerned that if minimum wage went up and there was no compensation on the other side, just like the long-term care people are saying, because there's the frozen, the Medicare rate is frozen for them. They can't raise any revenue, that they don't know how they would continue to serve these people with disabilities. I'm talking people that are completely incapable of standing, talking, walking. I saw 12 adults that were completely at the mercy of the people that were helping them. My concern is that we look at the totality of this change in not just in the silo, but in the totality of all the different things that we are talking about doing, and what is the full cost to the state of Minnesota, and how do we bear that cost from the private sector? Because it doesn't come from the government, because government doesn't produce anything. It comes from the private sector, who we've been hearing from testifier after testifier after testifier. So that is my concern, and that is what I would like to raise. I would like to see some sort of thought process as to how does this impact all of these rates, if we're really going to keep them into compliance, right, if we're going to ask them to go up to, if you're going to do the delete all the 1055 or 955 or whatever it is, how are we going to make all that work, and what does it cost us?
Mr. Chair, just to respond, I have to go vote upstairs, and I just want to say thank you, Representative O'Neill, for spending 4.5 hours in committee time looking at those very consequences. That's the whole point of having these joint hearings like this.
I want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to testify if they came here and had hoped to say something. So this is the opportunity. If you do, please come forward now, and we'll take your testimony. I don't see anybody. Anybody have any last comments before we adjourn? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just, I guess, a challenge to think about over the next few days while we continue this conversation, discussion. You know, I've been thinking, my phone was ringing earlier, and it was actually a barrage of emails coming in from different folks, both for and against the minimum wage. And so I was reading through the emails and listening to testimonies here. And one of the things I started to think about is back home. And we have a lot of small little mom-and-pop restaurants, as many of you in rural Minnesota and even in the metro here have. And the one difference I'd like to point out, because I think the point that people are hitting on here is, you know, we pay minimum wage, and, you know, on average, our servers are making $23 an hour or whatever it ends up being, different numbers for each business. And, you know, that's great, but there are a lot of areas where, in fact, you don't make a lot in tips. And, you know, the place I go to breakfast back home, or one of the places, I should say, I get in trouble with some of my business owners. But my favorite place to go, it's little hole-in-the-wall spot, and the same lady's been a waitress there for 20-plus years, knows my entire family, and I know she doesn't make a lot of money. She can't afford a house. She's been working her whole life, put her family through, and it kind of leads into what I was mentioning earlier in committee. I really challenge you to think that this isn't about the low income and only servers. This is about raising the bar for everyone. And I'm glad that we're all taking part in the discussion and making sure that we're thinking of the consequences, Representative O'Neill. And we do have to be cognizant of those. But overall, I'd just like to challenge you to think of, you know, not of this as a union issue or being pushed in because we want to help kids going to college. It's people whose lives are affected, who have kids in school, who can't pay their bills, and making sure that we as a government are looking out for them and saying, you know, you deserve, at the very least, with a minimum wage, to be able to have a roof over your head, some lights on, and the opportunity to just have a good family life, you know, even though you might have failed or succeeded in whatever other aspects of life. So,
thank you. Representative Kiefer, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rep. Metza, you're on a border state. You're in a border, right, or not?
Close enough, I guess, from here.
I don't know where you are. I don't pay attention to that side of the state. Anyway, okay, never mind. I am on a border. I'm 7 miles to Hudson, Wisconsin, and I just want to state on the record, I've been inundated with phone calls and emails today on this issue. And my LA said, Andrea, they're telling you, tell Rep. Kiefer that I'm moving to Hudson. I'm going to pick up my business. I'm going to rent my space in Hudson. Then I find out there with the liquor guys that the taxes on liquor are going to go up. So now they're going to go buy beer in Wisconsin, too. And it'll probably be on Sunday because we can't buy it here. Sorry, I had to plug that in. But it is something that I am hearing from my constituents, okay? And I just wanted people to know that. Thank you.
And one last comment on the list from Representative Benson, and we'll close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've bandied around a lot of numbers. We've had economists, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, and to the rest of the committee. I had two simultaneous committees going on, so I had to miss a ton. And I'm sure that there were a lot of other studies that were probably presented. But it comes down to these are people. And in the end, I know in your hearts that in the mind of the folks who are proposing that we raise the minimum wage to $10.55, or, you know, I think the delete all is going to get us to that at least by 2015. And I've said this before, but ultimately, if you know economics well enough, and you know supply and demand many other economic terms that I think we're late and you don't need to hear those things. It boils down to we're going to put a lot of people, potentially a lot of people, out of work. We're in a terrible economy still. I mean, last quarter. If you know about economics, you know it only takes two quarters of no growth so that we're back in officially into a recession. We had one quarter of no growth. I don't think there's a single economist out there who project we're going to see hardly any growth this quarter that we're in, given the fact that we just, you know, added the 2% back in. We're in a very precarious place. So even adding an incremental increase to 835 as the delete all in October's first will do would pose an extremely difficult situation for our economy and business. And ultimately, it comes down to not numbers. It comes down to your neighbors and people. People are going to graduate from college and high school that are going to be looking for jobs, and folks, they're not going to be there. And, you know, in as much as I want to lift everybody out of poverty, I live in a fantastic community in Rochester. We've got lots of high-paying jobs. We've got low unemployment. But the rest of the state ain't Rochester. And there's a lot of folks like our councilman that was here today that are counting on us to do the right thing. And honestly, folks, this is not the right thing, and it's not the right time. So I just pray that as we move forward, there is a Senate bill that I think makes probably a whole lot more sense, that where this isn't a compromise, you know, let's negotiate and get us down to the middle or something, because it's their bill probably is going to come closest to what we probably need to do if you're going to do anything. And take some time to reflect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Benson. I think we did have good discussion and good reflection on some of these important issues. I think we're not as far apart in a lot of these things as it appears at times. I want to thank the testifiers for coming out in the evening like this and being willing to spend some time and share their thoughts and opinions. And with that, at least for those in the labor, workplace, and regulated industries, we'll see you tomorrow morning. Meeting's adjourned.